Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
With Justin Brierley.
Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to a podcast special of Unbelievable This Week with me, Justin Brierley. No regular radio show this week on Premier Christian Radio because all of our usual programming has moved aside, as it does every so often, for a special fundraising appeal. It's our Premier Lifeline appeal, asking listeners to Premier Christian Radio to support the important work of all the volunteers and the whole organisation that comprises our telephone response line, Premier Lifeline, people phoning in with all kinds of different needs and gives out advice, prayer and everything else. If that's something you'd like to give to, it's not too late to do that. You can do it online very easily at premierchristianradio.com. It's an important part of Premier's overall ministry. But Unbelievable will be back in its usual format from next week. In fact, it'll be the third episode of our Big Conversation series, which is a special set of video debates. And we've had the first two go out already. Very exciting to see that we've had over 500,000 views on the YouTube video of our first Big Conversation episode. That was Jordan B. Peterson and Susan Blackmore in debate on whether we need God to make sense of life. And just recently as well, just this last week, Jordan Peterson has also put the audio out on his own podcast, and they're going to be uploading it to their own YouTube channel as well in due course. So it's exciting to see that particular show bringing Unbelievable to a whole new audience. And if you want to sign up to the Big Conversation newsletter yourself, to the Unbelievable newsletter, do go to the webpage and you can do that right there, thebigconversation.show. The second episode went out last week. That was Steven Pinker, well-known atheist psychologist from Harvard, debating Christian thinker Nick Spencer on whether science, reason and humanism are replacing faith. And just such a fantastic high level discussion between the two of them. Lots of love for that one as well. More modest on the video count, but still doing very well from our all new Unbelievable YouTube channel, where we've got lots of clips as well from those shows that you can access, where you can find lots of other material that we're adding on a regular basis from Unbelievable. So do search for Unbelievable on YouTube if you're a YouTube user. We've also got the new Unbelievable app, which is being downloaded by lots of people, and you can get your podcasts, your videos, your articles, and lots more all in one place on your phone using the Unbelievable app. So check that out in your Android or iPhone store, wherever you go and get your apps from. All of those details and more available, of course, from the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, where you can subscribe to the Unbelievable podcast. But if you're listening to this, you probably already do, because this is a podcast special of the program. Just before I introduce what I've got for you on this week's edition of the podcast, which was quite fun, a bit longer than usual, just a reminder, I teased this in last week's show, that Unbelievable is coming to the USA. Yes, Unbelievable the Conference USA is happening in Portland at Westside Church on Friday the 31st of August, beginning with a debate that evening that I'll be moderating, and then the all-day conference on Saturday the 1st of September. We still don't quite yet have the ability to book in yet, hoping to have that very soon, but please mark that date in your calendar if you think you can come, if you're somewhere on the West Coast and would like to get along, or maybe you're somewhere else in the USA and can fly in. You might want to make sure that you're there. I'll be there, and some fantastic speakers and guests will be present as well for our very first US conference. So look out for that. Friday, 31st of August, and Saturday, the 1st of September in Portland, Oregon. And finally, today's show, what have I got for you? Well, I sat down a few weeks ago to record a debate with David Smalley. He's the host of Dogma Debate. It's an atheist podcast in which he regularly engages with people of faith. Now, it's rather like Unbelievable in that sense, except normally I'm moderating the debates. There's usually a Christian and non-Christian joining me. Whereas in David's case, he tends to be the atheist presence, and then he brings on someone of another point of view, often a Christian, to debate them. Well, I was the guinea pig this time, the willing victim who entered into Dogma Debate and had a debate with David Smalley. Not something I do regularly, I must confess, though I'm quite happy to moderate debates. I'm a little bit more nervous of getting involved in them myself. But I do it from time to time. And he invited me to do this on the back of the fact that Unbelievable, the book, has been out for a year now. And he said, why don't we get you on and talk about the book and some of the points you raise in it? So we did that. And you will hear in the rest of today's podcast special what happened as we debate, particularly at length, the problem of evil and suffering, but also some aspects of the evidence for the resurrection and other things too. All of those are parts of the book. And if you want to read it for yourself, download a free chapter, get hold of the audiobook or signed copies of the book, it's all available from our own website. That's unbelievablebook.co.uk. And it's been great to see all the reactions we've had to the book since it was released last year. Again, unbelievablebook.co.uk for more info on the book, free chapter download, links to the audiobook, and where you can purchase signed copies too. It's my case for faith, why after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. But grilling me on whether it makes sense for me to still be a Christian after all these years of debates, here's my debate with Dogma Debate host David Smalley.
You all know my next guest. He is he's the host of Unbelievable, a nationwide radio show on UK premier Christian radio. It's also an extremely popular podcast. And now he's the author of a brand new book called Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. Join me in welcoming Justin Brierley to Dogma Debate. How you doing, man?
Thank you very much, David. I'm doing very well. It's great to connect with you today.
This is so long overdue. What have we been doing?
Wait, I know.
This is crazy. I did your show, but I never really got to talk to you about your faith. We only really I had that moment with Frank Turek, and not my best. And I enjoyed it, other than you made me get up at ungodly hours to communicate, which is always one of my first excuses when people go, what the hell happened to that Frank Turek debate? I was up at 5:30 in the morning. Yeah, I should have just stayed awake for that and not gone to sleep at all.
That's definitely my best tactic with making sure the atheists don't do very well. Get them up at an ungodly hour. You know, that's the best way to do it.
I love it. I love it. And I don't know how you made a whole book out of this, because I got to tell you, I already know the answer. Why after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian? You clearly haven't been listening. That's got to be the answer. Like, what took you so many pages to say I haven't been paying attention?
Well, you see, it's the fact that I wrote this book before we had our one with you, and obviously that was the one that tipped me over the edge. So you know how it is.
I love it. So did you have any like official apologetics training, or did you go to any sort of Christian schools or anything, or did you take the broadcast route just as a lay Christian saying I would like to share the good news? How did you build all of this?
Well, I didn't have any formal apologetics training, that's for sure, or really any formal theological training. I grew up a Christian. I sort of had a conversion experience really in my late teens, and I went to university. I did politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford, and that was great for instilling some of the basics of, you know, how to think and, you know, how to criticize and how to write a decent essay. And it obviously helped me with some of the philosophical basis of things. Sure. But it was really only when I began my broadcasting career with Premier Christian Radio in the UK that I started to look into the whole idea of doing some kind of a Christian, non-Christian debate show. And that was really where I got my teeth stuck into the whole area of apologetics and theology.
Oh, wait. So you had a job with UK Premier Christian Radio before you were really into apologetics?
Yeah. Yeah, completely.
So what were you doing with them?
Well, I kind of came out of university, got married, and after a gap year with my wife, she began training for ministry in the church. And I started with Premier Christian Radio because I was interested in doing broadcasting. I'd had okay. some work experience with a radio station, really loved it. And an opportunity came up with Premier Christian Radio just to really learn the ropes of broadcasting. And so I started doing the kind of being the sidekick on the daily breakfast show, learning the art of interviewing, creating features, writing stories. And 3 years in, I went to the boss of the station and said, look, I'd love to create a space within our schedule where we don't just talk to Christians about Christian things, as valuable as that is, but we actually kind of model how to talk to non-Christians and how to have fruitful conversations. And Unbelievable was born out of that, really, just an hour and a half in the schedule each week when we would actually invite non-Christians onto the station in order to have these kinds of conversations.
That's wonderful. Did you get any pushback from some higher up saying we're not going to, you know, use our airwaves to promote an atheist agenda?
Well, I certainly got pushback from some of the listeners. In fact, the management were quite open to the idea and sort of saw the value in it. But it was some of the longtime listeners who said to me, you know, look, what are you doing inviting all these atheists and skeptics on, Justin? We've got far too many of them on the BBC already. We don't need them on our Christian radio station, for goodness sake. So there was some pushback to start with. But I think basically people who enjoyed it, loved it, and they wanted more of it. The people who didn't like it kind of learned to skip that hour and a half on a Saturday when it happened. Eventually I think people have, honestly, they've just got used to it because it's been such a long-standing part of the schedule now. People understand what it's there for. They understand they're not always going to hear views that they agree with, but they understand the long-term benefit of having this kind of a dialogue show. And actually, in many ways, the show exists just as much now for the podcast audience, which includes a lot of atheists and agnostics as well, of course, via podcast.
I mean, that's cool. I mean, that's, you know, you're falling right in line, I think, with 1 Peter 3:15 and, you know, being able to give reasons for the hope that you have and doing so with gentleness and respect. At the end of the day, you know, arming Christians with better arguments in favor of their own faith can only be a positive thing. And if someone listens to your show and hears an atheist that has a good point, they shouldn't plug their ears and run away. They should look into it, learn how to defend it. And if it doesn't make sense to them, then they're in the wrong faith. And if it does make sense to them and they strengthen their faith, either way it goes, it's an improvement, right?
Yeah.
They're becoming more true to themselves.
You're preaching to the choir here. I completely agree. And I think that the point is that, unfortunately, there has been a kind of viewpoint in the church where there has been a lack of confidence and people run away from tough questions and objections. And in many ways, The Unbelievable Show is not your typical kind of apologetics show, in as much as you do hear the other side and you hear a very cogent objections to Christianity a lot of the time. So it is uncomfortable listening for many Christians, but in a way, it's only by having that experience that you'll actually grow the kind of thick skin, in my opinion, that you actually need in order to engage in a fruitful way with skeptics. So for me, it's not necessarily the easiest thing to do, especially if you're kind of new to this whole area. You may hear things that you never even realized were issues or problems or objections. But in the long run, I found it's actually really strengthened my faith. It's been a confidence booster. Not that there aren't any questions or mysteries or things that I struggle with still, but nonetheless, I've actually found it to be really helpful in the long term.
Yeah, no, it's great. And it sounds like you and I were on very similar paths. And that's very much the way I started Dogma Debate. Most people don't know this. The first time I actually typed anything or registered anything having to do with Dogma Debate, it was 2006. And then in 2008, I launched the blog. And then 2010 was the first version of the radio show / podcast. And then in 2012, it's in its current format. And that part has lasted 6 years. And it sounds like you've been going for a very long time. What, 11, 12 years or so?
It's over 12 years now. So we started back in the end of 2005. And wow. It was really, for the first year and a half, it was just a radio show. And then we started podcasting it. And gradually, just very organically, it started to grow as both Christians and atheists started to pick it up. I think we saw kind of leaps in the listenership every time I managed to get a big name on, either from the atheist or Christian world. So, you know, when I had a PZ Myers on, for instance, or someone like that, and they posted the episode to their blog, you'd suddenly get a load of new people start downloading the podcast. And that was great. And so we've been really pleased with the way it's grown. We had last year, we had over 3 million downloads of the show across all the episodes. And so it's been great to engage with lots of different people, both Christian and non-Christian, from around the world because of that.
Very cool, man. Well, congratulations on that success. And I'm pretty confident that anyone who hasn't heard of you, who listens to this show, they're going to go check out Unbelievable. So, I mean, Unbelievable? Because it does have a question mark at the end of it.
That's
so yeah,
right.
Definitely go check that out on Apple Podcast. Justin's a great guy. And, I'm amazed. You know, we should probably do this on a regular basis, like once every month or every other month. We've got to connect and talk, because we're so much in lock and step about the method by which to discuss these things, that the ideas need to be heard. And of course, we're going to be respectful to one another and we don't mind taking jabs back and forth.
Yeah.
So I think we could have great conversations
because
your show is like the Christian version of what Dogma Debate has been for the last 6 years. So
absolutely. It's refreshing. Yeah. I think Dogma Debate has so much in common with Unbelievable. As you say, in my case, it's a Christian presenting it on a Christian radio network. And in your case, obviously an atheist in a kind of secular environment. But yeah, we're essentially doing the same thing. We've got some really exciting stuff actually coming up, David, that I should mention. We've got in just a couple of weeks' time, a new series within Unbelievable launching. We're calling it The Big Conversation. And we've got some really exciting guests. We're shooting them in kind of high quality video as well. So we're hoping they'll get a lot of views on YouTube and so on. And we've got guests like Jordan B. Peterson in debate with an atheist psychologist, Susan Blackmore. We've got Steven Pinker on with a Christian thinker on the whole issue of humanism, science and reason. We've got Daniel Dennett debating consciousness with Keith Ward, who's one of the leading Christian philosophers of mind. Derren Brown, who you may not be as familiar with in the US.
I do know who he is. Yeah, I know who he is.
He's very big here in the UK. He's an illusionist of stage and screen and well known as an atheist as well. And he's in conversation with a well known Christian, the Reverend Richard Coles, on the search for happiness. And we've got further shows that we're recording soon with people like Peter Singer debating ethics. And we've got a live debate as well in London that we're recording for this series between John Lennox and Michael Roos on science, faith, atheism and the evidence for God. So that's all going to start rolling out from the 9th of June. And if people want more info and to register for the newsletter where you get all the downloads and all the bonus content and so on, that's all at the website, which is thebigconversation.show.
Okay, thebigconversation.show. And the website for the book is unbelievablebook.co.uk. It's also available on Amazon and everything else. Well, let's jump into it. I have your chapter titles here, and I just want to kind of take you through the some of the titles, because the question you ask in the title of your book is something I've often wondered. People will say, you know, I just had a guy on the other day who's a Christian researcher who was like, you know, I see people leaving religion at phenomenal rates. They're leaving so fast. And I'm like, well, if you're studying people who are leaving religion, what makes you stay in it? Do you ever see the reason they leave and go, gosh, that's a great idea. You know, that's a good point. Maybe I should rethink my faith. So I'm really curious as to all of the debates you've been exposed to over 12 years. Has there been anything, but before we even get into the chapter titles, has there been anything, or I guess what is the strongest thing? What is the strongest argument you've heard against your own position?
Well, I've heard lots of strong arguments against my position, and in a way, I've heard things I never even realized were objections until I started the show. So it's been very much a process of putting myself in the firing line of the objections. And yeah, I guess, you know, in terms of the strongest objections, you could go obviously to the classic one, the problem of suffering and evil, because when that's put by a cogent, in an emotional way, in a way that really grabs you, then it's a very strong argument, you know, against Christianity. Why would a loving God allow some of the terrible things that do exist in the world? So those have certainly been some of the most challenging kinds of discussions. You know, when I first had Bart Ehrman on to debate the historical reliability of the Gospels, you know, he's a very winsome, cogent, good communicator who has obviously had a great influence on, you know, making a lot of people question the historicity of the Gospels, because he was a believer at one time. He lost his faith, and he's a well-known New Testament scholar now who has written a lot of stuff critiquing the historicity of the scriptures and so on. So that was a challenge to me when I first started reading his stuff and brought him on for the first time to have a debate on the show. Now I've worked my way through those issues, obviously, and there are ways in which I've come to understand those and find that there are ways actually where I'm happy that I've resolved them, at least to my own satisfaction, in some way.
Real quick on the problem of evil, I do want to say I just did a debate on Friday on a show called The Non Sequitur Show. So if anyone wants to see that debate, it's Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. And they may have split it into two parts. Hopefully they've got it into one video. There was a technical glitch. The second half of that show that we did was really powerful, and so powerful, I will say, I won't give it away, but I'll tell you that the apologist I was debating said something at the end in his closing remarks that I've never heard anyone say in a debate ever. So I would really strongly recommend everyone go type in Non Sequitur Show on YouTube and you'll find it. If you just type it into Google, it'll lead you to either their podcast or the YouTube portion. Definitely go check that out. The problem of evil is something I come back to quite often. Even if I don't mean to, and even if we don't say up front we're going to talk about the problem of evil, I often, Justin, try to put my Christian hat on and remember my faith and remember my belief. And then I start thinking about God even from a Christian perspective, just conceding that God exists at the beginning of the conversation and then talking about that God. And I go through this struggle of, even if I knew for a fact that God did exist, I don't know that I could force myself to worship him, because I don't think, if the Bible is true about its attributes and God's behaviors, my argument is that God, even from a Christian morals perspective, wouldn't be worthy of worship. And so have you ever heard that argument? You may have heard me say it before, but have you ever heard that argument, and how do you reconcile that just personally?
Yeah, I certainly I've heard that before, not just from you, David. I think that, to be honest, it's not so much the issue of the Bible and what it says about God that has caused me trouble, though obviously that we've debated that many times. I guess for me, I've always, I've always understood the Bible as being interpreted through the lens of Jesus Christ, that is God's ultimate revelation to us. And in a sense, that is the lens through which I kind of interpret the rest of the scriptures. But the issue of suffering, obviously, is a difficult one. You know, just this, when we're confronted with terrible evil and gratuitous suffering, why would God allow that if God is able to stop that? And so in a sense, I've been through the same journey as you, and asked myself the same kind of questions. As I say, I guess there are no easy answers to these things, and it'd be crazy of me to suggest that, you know, there's some simple way of simply sorting all of that out. We can go down that route, but I think there are some ways of understanding why suffering exists, why God might have reasons for allowing suffering to exist. And I suppose in the end, I also kind of look at this, as I try to do throughout the book. I try to put the two different worldviews together, atheism or naturalism versus Christianity. And for me, I think the problem of suffering is still a problem, actually, on a naturalistic worldview, because there is still a fact of suffering. But the problem is there's no meaning. There's no rhyme or reason to it. It just is the way the world is. There's a bruteness to it, and there's no answer to it. It just is. And so in a sense, for me, that means that the issue of suffering is a meaningless question almost on an atheistic, naturalistic worldview.
Well, let me ask. It's a great, Let's go ahead and dive into it. I was going to go in order. This is actually, you cover this in chapter 7, but I wanted, since we sort of just organically rolled into it, let's just go ahead and start with that. Let's say for a moment, and I just want to pull it out of religion to sort of draw this analogy. Let's say that you own property and you're trying to keep it protected. And you contract me and you say, hey, David, I need you to just make sure this area stays safe. And I say, okay, I'm going to hire a security guard with the money you're giving me and we're going to make sure that everything's all right. And you say, okay. And then somebody breaks into the property and you're like, David, what happened? I'm like, oh, trust me. Somebody was watching over it, but these things are just going to happen from time to time. But he was watching over it, keep paying me. After so many break-ins and so many levels of destruction, you're going to go, hey, where's this security guard that's supposed to be here? Can we have a discussion with him about what he's doing? What is he looking at during the break-ins? You know, does he care about his job? Oh, trust me. He absolutely loves his job. He loves the property. He loves us. He's a great guy. But this is just the way the world is. And you're like, no. I'm paying money for this guy to be here. And you see where I'm going with this. At some point, you're going to start thinking I'm taking advantage of you. There is no real guard. I'm taking your money and I haven't really hired anyone because the very evidence of bad things happening to your property is evidence that either the security guard isn't really there or he's absolutely terrible at his job or he doesn't care about the property like he said he did whenever I told you I hired him. So at some point you would stop believing that there's a security guard there. So just accepting that that's the way it is when God is supposed to love us and be there for us. And in Psalms 121:7, you know, I will keep you from all harm. The Lord is watching over you and will keep you from harm. These ideas that we have this overseer who loves us and is caring for us, yet terrible things consistently happen. At some point, it's evidence that that guard isn't there. Or if it is there, it doesn't care about us. So how do you reconcile that with just, you know, sort of just saying, well, that's the way things are, so it's a pointless question? I think it's super meaningful because it comes down to either God doesn't care about us at all or he doesn't exist.
Yeah. And I guess my response to that would be that I don't think God is a divine security guard. I don't think that's what God's job is. I think if you have a picture of God, which is basically a divine security guard or a divine childminder who's basically there to keep us secure and comfortable and happy, then yeah, God isn't doing his job if you experience any pain or suffering in your life because you hired the babysitter to keep you comfortable and safe and happy and that hasn't happened. But I don't think that's what God is. That's not my picture of God whatsoever.
Doesn't God do that repeatedly though throughout the Bible? He intervenes with people he cares about. He kills people he doesn't like.
He acts in various ways to achieve certain purposes, but I wouldn't say that God's job is to keep us safe and sound. I mean, Jesus died a horrible death on the cross. It wasn't necessarily God's ultimate purpose to make sure Jesus was kept safe and sound. Most of the Christians, if the New Testament, died pretty horrific deaths. Being a Christian and following God is not a guarantee in any way. No one's ever claimed that it's some guarantee to safe, secure happiness.
Well, so I get that.
So but my point though, which is simply that what might the picture of God be that we need? Well, my view is that actually God is far more interested in people coming to a knowledge of him. And it may be that actually the way that God reaches people and people come to a knowledge of him is through a whole variety of different ways, which may not involve them being safe and secure. And it may be that God can use all kinds of different circumstances, including a certain level of suffering, to bring people to a knowledge of him and to love him. And I think God's far more interested in that than keeping us safe, secure, and happy, because I don't think God's actually that interested in that. I think he's interested in us coming to know and love him. So I'd say that's the key difference between your analogy and the way I conceive God.
Sure, but wouldn't you say that if he did keep his followers and believers safe and secure and happy, that would bring more people close to him?
Well, you could guess that, but I don't think you're in a position to know that, actually. I think that's doesn't necessarily follow at all. You know, it may be that people being safe, secure, and happy means they forget about God. In fact, if you look at the world, it kind of looks a bit like that, because in the safe, secure West, relatively, people tend to forget about God. Whereas I look at other parts of the world where there's far less security, and it appears like people depend far more on God. So in an ironic way, I think the world itself suggests that that's not the way it works most of the time.
Well, I mean, in the situation, let's say everyone who goes to church and professes Christianity never got cancer or had any terrible, absolutely terrible things happen for them. And anytime there was a tornado ripping through Oklahoma or the Midwest, the churches were always avoided and only atheist houses were destroyed or only Muslim houses were destroyed. If it was overwhelmingly obvious that Christians got special treatment, not just by the government, but by God. And if you go to church, bad things stop happening to you. I think more and more people would be like, hey, there's something to this Christianity thing. I had cancer when I was an atheist. I began praying and became a Christian, and now my cancer went away. That's what I'm getting at. If you did offer some sort of safe haven for Christians, more people would become that.
Maybe, but again, maybe God's not interested in people just following him because of the great benefits it offers in terms of, you know, maybe God has deeper purposes than that, David, and,
sure.
and that he actually wants people to find him in the midst of suffering. It may be that actually part of the way in which we become truly human is through experiencing what it is to know God, even in the midst of suffering, that there may be greater goods that are actually achieved in a world where such things exist.
Sure. So you mentioned a second ago that you don't think it's God's job to be the security guard. And that's a fair point. But I'll ask this. Let's say you're walking down the street and you see a car that, say, the engine is on fire. And in the back seat, there's a 3-year-old strapped into a car seat. Now, you're not in any super danger by walking up to that car and opening. It's a small fire in the engine. But if you do nothing, you know the child is going to die. Is it your job to save the child?
Yeah, I'd say for me, it is my job to save the child. I should do
what
I can.
Why is that your job?
Because I believe that with the knowledge I have, the best thing I can do in that circumstance is to attempt to save that child. That's kind of the position I'm in.
Okay.
And that would be my response.
So then if you believe God is everywhere all the time and can also see the same car fire and can also see the same kid and also has the ability, because he is all powerful, to remove the kid from the car, is it also God's job to save the kid?
Again, I can't second guess the whole time what God knows. I mean, God sees things from a vastly different perspective to us. We all know that there are situations where things happen where we don't know the full situation and we might have acted differently in a given situation. I can only do what seems like the best thing in that situation. Why God doesn't always step in supernaturally? Well, there are a huge number of other factors that we simply cannot be aware of or not necessarily know, which may be playing into that. I mean, I think the fact is that God doesn't, one simple way in which I think we can kind of fairly easily understand why God doesn't always intervene in every single situation where some suffering is going to occur, where he could possibly avert it, is because a lot of the time that would actually simply mean we don't live in a world with free will. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with this argument, but that mm-hmm. there are plenty of examples of where God, if God constantly overrode people's free will by causing them to do the right thing and not the wrong thing, then
yeah, but I don't want to get off with that. I don't want to get off on free will, Justin, because we're talking about a specific situation in which you would save the child from a burning car. And mm-hmm. God, if God doesn't, you just assume that he had other knowledge and just continue to believe in him. As to where if I were to walk by, if you were to mm-hmm. see me walk by the car, look in, see the kid and turn around and walk away, I think you would judge me for that. I think you would be like, how terrible of David to do. Let's say you saw a video of me doing it. You weren't there to do anything about it. And you saw me walk by, look at the kid in the car, make eye contact, and then just turn around and walk away and let the kid burn up in the car. You would judge me for that. And at the same time, you don't know what I know. I might have information that you're missing, but you would still think, gosh, what a terrible thing for David Smalley to do, to not reach in and pull that kid out, right? But it seems for some reason when God ignores that, he just gets a pass. And this is a conversation I've had multiple times on my show. He gets a pass on the hope you hope that God has some knowledge that you don't have that makes it okay that he ignores the suffering.
Well, I don't think he ignores the suffering. I think the whole point is that the whole Christian story is that God is very much aware of the suffering and has come into the suffering in the person of Jesus Christ. But yeah, I do believe in a world where suffering happens and God doesn't constantly intervene to stop it. So, and I do believe that there are hypothetically good reasons why that might be. And I try to explain some of them in the book. I can't give you a reason for every single instance why God allowed, for instance, you know, some disaster to occur in a car with a 3-year-old or whatever it might be. I'm not in a position, obviously, to have that kind of knowledge, but I'm satisfied that it's perfectly possible that God does have ultimate reasons in all kinds of different ways that I cannot simply know about, which in the end makes sense of this. I'm not saying that I'm going to make sense of it, though, in every situation. But yeah, to some extent, I am going on the idea that I think it's in principle possible for God to have reasons that are beyond our ability to know. It down to the point that even to some extent, there simply is a cosmic battle of good and evil going on in the world. I do believe in a kind of spiritual realm, and that God doesn't always get his way in that sense, that there is a sense in which there is a kind of, you know, a cosmic battle of good and evil, in which we are called as Christians to be on the side of God, but there are ways, because of the freedom God has given to the whole of the creation, including the spiritual dimension of the creation, there are ways in which that is manifesting itself. And I don't think God constantly just swoops in to kind of magic everything better, because I think he has ultimate purposes, which even with a suffering world and where terrible things happen, can still play into his ultimate purposes. So I just don't think it's as simple as saying, you know, if you did wrong by not stepping in and doing something in that situation, that God did wrong by not. Because I just don't think we have the kind of picture that God has on it.
Okay, you said a couple of different things there that I wanted to make notes on, and I'm not really sure. I feel like we could branch off in either one of those and go into deeper conversation. So I want to kind of touch on them and then come back and see where you are with it. You said something about it being a possibility, or you said you were satisfied that God could have a reason for allowing things to happen. And so that is one possibility. I will say that as extremely minute as I believe the percentage is, I'll concede that there's some extremely small percentage that there is some God out there that has knowledge that we don't have that would make somehow, it feels weird even saying it, but that somehow a 3-year-old being strapped in a car seat in a car fire could somehow do some good. The facts of reality are screaming in my head saying, what are you talking about? There's no way. But because I don't have all knowledge in the universe, I'll say there's a minute something I could be missing.
Let me just clarify, because I don't even think that necessarily we have to say that God has some ultimate good in mind when something terrible like that happens. I don't think necessarily actually God, that is necessarily quite the way it works. I think that bad stuff happens because there is a cosmic war going on. We live in a fallen world. And so for me, it's not just that God may have other purposes. It's that there are circumstances which God has, if you like, is beholden to, is has decided to allow to be the case because of some greater purpose of free will or whatever it might be in the world. That means that things that are not actually things that are God knows are wrong, are not his will in that sense, happen. And so I'm saying that it's a range of things that for me are potentially in the background, things that we don't necessarily see up front. But sorry, I'll let you carry on, David.
Yeah, no, it's a hope that you have, though, right? It's not something that you believe is. It's you hope that there is some answer out there that makes this okay.
Well, I guess it's more than just a hope. It is a hope. That's true. But I suppose it's for me confirmed in the person of Jesus Christ. I suppose for me, it's not just some theoretical hope. It's actually been established in what Jesus Christ has done, in actually overcoming death and redeeming suffering in a way that for me gives me ultimate hope and purpose, that is God's ultimate kind of way in which God deals with things. So even the awful situation you've described, God will actually make a world where that is redeemed, where all of that is taken into account. It's not meaningless. It's not purposeless. I think the problem for me is that on a naturalistic view, that is just a meaningless, purposeless thing. It's just the horribleness of life. I accept that you may think this is pie in the sky, but I honestly think that in a Christian worldview, even though I can't give an answer to that now, God, in God's goodness and graciousness, all of those things will one day be redeemed in some significant way.
Well, okay. So again, I still have those two things that I want to get to. And I promise I'm going to come back to the cosmic war thing. That's super, super interesting to me. So I'm going to come back on that. And I'm really interested in how that could be redeemed, because we're not just talking about a child dying or someone dying. I get it. God could snap his fingers and the kid could go to heaven and avoid all this. I don't understand how the fire, the smoke, the melting of the skin, the pain the kid is going to go through before he dies. There's no justifiable reason for that. If the kid needs to die for some greater purpose, and I don't understand that, okay, God may have some, but in such a horrific way, in suffocating, in, you know, all the things that would happen to a child strapped into a seat in a burning car, no matter what God said, here's why that kid had to die that way. But why did he have to feel that pain? Why did he have to have his face melted off? Why did he have to suffocate and inhale all of the smoke? I mean, come on. These aren't things that could ever be redeemed for any reason. That seems to me, that's one of my biggest objections. It just doesn't make sense that it would have to go in that way. We could say the same thing with leukemia, a very slow, extremely painful death. I mean, these things wouldn't have to be this way. And I'll add to this, Justin, if you think that that does have to happen this way in order for God to accomplish something greater, doesn't that mean God is not all powerful? If he needs a prerequisite, if that has to happen before he can do something else, he doesn't have all the power of the universe, because he needs tools to make things happen. I'm not all powerful, so I need a wrench to remove a bolt, right? I need the prerequisite in order to make my goal happen. So if God needs a child to burn in the back of a car in order to accomplish some other greater good or some other goal, then he's not all powerful. And that brings me to the first challenge of that. Before we get into the cosmic war, you said it was possible, or it satisfies you that there's something, some reason out there that would somehow make this okay. Are you also open to the possibility that bad things happen because the world doesn't care about you and God doesn't exist, and that's why these things happen? Is that also a possibility for you?
Oh, sure. That is a possibility. That's the other alternative, you know, and that's the one that I obviously, that's the whole reason why I have found this argument a challenging one. You know, because that's the obvious other alternative, is that I'm just, you know, making things up in order to try and, you know, get God off the hook. And of course, it's the reason why a lot of people have lost their faith, because they couldn't find a way to reconcile the God of love with the reality of the suffering in the world. But as I say, so the example you're giving, and, you know, and you're right to point to something as horrible as this kind of an example, because these are the things that do happen in the world. The problem is, I think you're mischaracterizing what I actually think God is doing or allowing. The way that you're putting it is as though God kind of has manufactured a situation where a child has to go through excruciating, horrible things in order for some greater good that God has in mind to come out of it. I don't think God, I don't believe God creates or manufactures these situations. And in that sense, I'm not, you know, what you might call a Calvinist, say, who maybe does believe that all of these things have kind of been foreordained in some way, in some grand plan. I think that we live in a world that's free, in a world where bad things do happen. And I believe that when bad things happen, they're bad, you know, they are actually not the way the world should be. But in God's providence and grace, he can use even bad things to bring about some greater purpose, some greater good. That doesn't stop them being bad. That doesn't stop God weeping over them, just as Jesus wept.
Okay, well,
over
hold on. Could he also though have made those whatever that greater purpose is? Could he not have made that greater purpose happen without the bad thing happening?
I don't know. That kind of means that we kind of put ourselves in the position of God. All I know is that we do live in a world where bad things happen, where the world, people, you know, create cars that go faulty and burst into fire sometimes. And that is the world we live in. It's a world in which, you know, free will has its place, in which natural stuff has its place. I think it's all part of, it's all woven into the fact we live in a kind of a world that is out of kilter at some cosmic level, a world that is not the way it should be. And for me, as a Christian, the way I deal with that is the fact that we're given the hope, in a sense, of a world that will one day be restored, redeemed, and put back into order, where everything will be put right. But I also have this faith, yeah, in a God who will ultimately take every wrong thing and, you know, as the book of Revelation puts it, wipe every tear away from every eye, and that there will be an ultimate restoration and redemption of all these things, even the worst things that have happened in the world. God has the ability in his grace to make something good. And that's kind of the story of Christianity, that, you know, because, yeah, does a child deserve to go through any of that? No. Did Jesus deserve to be killed in the most excruciating way? No. But God can produce extraordinary things, even so, even in a world that is that terrible. So for me, that's where I go. I don't think of God as sort of orchestrating necessarily terrible things to happen for some greater purpose, but I believe in a God who's amazing enough to bring about a world, a good thing in the end, even despite the suffering that exists in the world.
Okay, so this is perfect, because this could lead us directly into this cosmic war thing, because really the reason this is an argument for me, and this was one of the most powerful things that happened in that non sequitur show debate on Friday, is, and by the way, my opponent there was a Calvinist, which made this conversation much different. But I will say, for me, it just comes down to the introduction of unnecessary evil. And it's almost sort of a, it's very Epicurean the way I've set this up. And I didn't mean to, it came out that way. And then I thought, wow, that sounds like sort of what Epicurus was doing. But I'll say this. So like, essentially, if God, is all powerful, he doesn't need a prerequisite in order to make good things happen. If God allows the bad thing to happen with the hope that he can make something good out of it, that then also suggests that he needs or wants this bad thing to happen so that he can make something good of it. And then when we ask, well, couldn't he just make that good thing happen without the bad? Well, if you say no, he needs that bad thing to happen, then he's not all powerful. And why do we call him God? And if you say yes, he could make that good thing happen without the bad thing happening, then God has allowed an unnecessary, gratuitous, evil thing to take place that was completely unnecessary in order for him to accomplish his goals. And so we end up in this situation of wondering, why would God create evil in the first place if he didn't need it to happen in order to accomplish the good in the world? And then it just makes it sound like if God exists, he is evil because he wants these things to happen or allows these things to happen when they're ultimately unnecessary.
Well, look, let me tell you a story in response to that, David. So one of the most phenomenal people I ever interviewed on the show about the issue of suffering is a guy called Will Pearson G, and he told this story in which he essentially he wasn't a Christian at one time, and he had a wife and two young kids, and I'm just trying to find it in the chapter here so I can read it properly, and he this was going back into the mid 90s, something like that. And sorry, let me just find the passage so that I can read this properly for you. Here we go. Just finding it somewhere here. Okay. Okay, here we go. Yeah. So he, Will Pearson Gee, as a young father, experienced the tragedy of losing both his wife and one of his children in a terrible road accident. Now, his wife had been returning from a day at the beach with their two children when her car, for reasons unknown, swerved into the path of an articulated truck. And obviously, Will's world fell apart. And he was called to identify their bodies in the mortuary. And this is how he described that to me in that show. He says, they pulled back the white sheets and I ranted and I screamed and I wept. Then I looked at them and I thought, this cannot be the end. There was so much life, particularly in my little boy. He was such a handful. I just couldn't believe it was the end of him. At the time, I was definitely a nominal Christian. I believed there was some higher power, but I really had no idea about his character or whether he cared about me. Then my eye was drawn to a very simple crucifix on the wall of the mortuary. It was a sign of the Christian faith to which I'd been exposed since I was a child, but never really thought anything about. It's like a penny dropped, and it suddenly became not just a cross, but a sign of hope for me. I then realized that if there was all this talk about resurrection and life after death, I needed to find out more about it. So that was the kind of event which caused Will to eventually become a Christian. In fact, he ended up becoming an Anglican priest. And Will says that he would never have wished that accident to happen, obviously. But nevertheless, he's seen that biblical imperative in Romans 8, which that in all things God works for the good of those who love him. And he says he's seen that proved true in his own life. And so the reason I tell that story is that could God have achieved bringing Will to a knowledge of him without that accident? Maybe there's some other way in which God could do it. But I don't know.
If he's all powerful, there has to be a way. Well, that's my whole point.
But God is, in a sense, has opted to limit himself because of human freedom. So God is all powerful, but God has, if you like, conscribed a certain set of he's decided to forego some of what he would be able to do,
right, but Justin,
in order to allow human freedom to exist. And that is the world in which we live. And so there's a sense in which I think there are some things that God that only can be achieved through a certain level of suffering in the world, and there's a sense in which God uses the suffering that does exist in the world to bring about those purposes. So I'm saying that there are things which, in a sense, because of God's willingness to allow us human freedom, he has, if you like, said, this is the way it has to be. This is the way I'm going to bring about this greater good because of the freedom that I think is worth it. And God could of course, God could, in theory, snap his magic fingers and make Will believe in him. But that would not be Will coming to believe in him in a free way. That would simply be
God
forcing.
Hold on, but that's a false dichotomy, though, Justin, because he could have Will stumble across a beautiful sight or see a flower grow or have his wife wake up after being pronounced dead and say, Jesus told me to come back and tell you he's real. And he could have had his family and his faith. It's not just either God snaps magic fingers or allows this absolutely horrific tragedy to happen to Will.
What you're anticipating is there is that you think you know what would freely bring Will to that point of accepting Jesus.
Well, my point is that God can make anything convincing.
But God can't. What God can't do, if he's going to honor our free will, is simply make us believe things without God. I think God has to work with our free will. And there's a sense in which we don't know what would have brought Will to the point of coming to faith in Christ.
And do you think that Will going to Christ is more important than the lives of his family?
No, I'm not in a position to make that judgment, and I don't think that's the way. I don't think God has kind of traded off two lives for Will's salvation.
That's what it sounds like, though.
But that's not what I'm trying to say here. I'm not saying that God sets things up in order to create. I'm saying that in a world in which two of Will's family members tragically died, that was the situation in which God was able to reach Will, and in a way that honored Will's freedom. And for me, that's a very different thing to God kind of being some puppet master who sets up situations. It's about God actually working within the framework of our freedom to bring us to the knowledge of him even in a world in which there is suffering, which I don't think God's rubbing his hands with glee that Will's wife and child died. I think God is desperately sad about the world that we live in a world where that happens. But God, in his goodness and grace, is able to redeem suffering even so. So I guess we're kind of coming around to the same thing. I'm not a Calvinist in that sense. I'm not probably going to be giving the same argument as this other chap you were talking to. But my view is that even so, God is able to achieve his purposes in ways that he may not be able to in a different kind of setting. Yeah, I guess I'm saying I don't think we can second guess that God could have done it a different way. Because I think God is circumscribed freely. He's chosen to allow us free will. And that means God can't simply make things happen in the way that we might expect.
Right. But allowing his family to live isn't obfuscating any free will. It's just not. I mean,
it may be because that if the point is if the driver coming in the opposite direction that hit their car had fallen asleep at the wheel or something like that, if God is sort of basically zapping the driver to make him stay awake, God, you're starting a situation where God is basically
Let me break in there. Let's say the guy has free will to slam into the car, and the car flips and rolls, and they're on the brink of death. God could stop them from dying. That's not intervening with free will. The guy still hit them. The guy still did what he wanted to do.
But it is to some extent intervening with the consequences of free will, which is one and the same thing, I guess. It's just semantics. It's the point is that God, you know, we could demand of God at every moment to never allow any bad consequences from our bad choices, you know. So I might hit someone, but God dulls the pain and causes the cells to regrow so that there's no damage. Well, I think God is still basically being the puppet master in that situation and not allowing free will to actually have its consequences. So I think it's one and the same, if I'm honest, David.
Yeah, I understand. And I think that's an extreme version of it. But I mean, in this case that we're actually talking about, this actual situation that happened to Will, whenever I said he could have brought Will to Christ any other way, you said, well, you're assuming that that would work. And then the focus of the conversation shifted to convert Will by any means necessary, even if we have to allow his family to die in a terrible accident. And then it seems that the main goal becomes Will's conversion to Christianity, even if his family has to die to convert him. And that's where I start to get disturbed by it, that we can make these arguments to justify it, that as long as someone comes to Christ after an absolute tragedy, then that means it's worth it. And I've said multiple times on my show, some things aren't worth paradise. And yeah, I don't know.
But Will himself said he would never have wished that to happen. I mean, no one, we're not saying God's, you know, I'll just reiterate, I'm not saying that there's some kind of trade-off that God's decided, oh, it's Will's salvation is worth the lives of his wife and child. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that in a world in which that happens, God is able to bring redemption of different kinds out of it. I'm not saying that that there couldn't have been necessarily a different way if Will's wife and child hadn't died that day, that God couldn't have found a different way. But nonetheless, the very simple point I'm making is that God is able, despite the nature of the world we live in, to redeem suffering. And I'm not saying that there's some calculation you can do which says, well, that was definitely worth that much suffering for the good it produced. I'm not saying that is the calculation you're making. I'm just saying there is, I believe in a God who will ultimately make sense of all the suffering in some bigger picture.
I understand. And my whole point is, if he's truly all powerful, he doesn't need those things to happen. It's not acceptable for anybody else to intentionally limit their powers. Nobody else can do that. If police officers intentionally said, well, I mean, I could save that person, but I don't want to intervene with their free will, they would lose their jobs.
Well, judges,
Justin, if I could finish this point. Judges are the same way. If judges said, well, I'm going to intentionally limit myself and turn the other way and ignore this evidence because I want your free will to, what? Parents are the same way with a 3-year-old. If a 3-year-old's walking toward an outlet with a fork, they don't get to say, well, I mean, I could stop them. But I want that child to have the choice to create, you know, an electrical fire and shock themselves. So I don't want to intervene with their free will, so I'm going to allow that to happen. What if a lifeguard did that? You know, I could jump out there and swim and save that person, but you know what? That's their free will, or at least the consequences of their free will. So I'm going to intentionally limit my power. Marines are the same way. Anybody in the army. Yeah, I could kill this person and stop them from setting off a bomb, but you know what? They had the free will to do that. Firemen are the same way. If you pulled up to a fire and there was a fire truck sitting out front and a house is just completely burning down. And you're like, what are you guys doing? You're not trying to put out the fire. They're like, look, every fire, every house that burns down, there's this really cool chemical that happens at the bottom of that. And we can actually use that to create an extinguisher for other fires. Well, is there another way you could find that extinguishing material? Oh, yeah, there's other ways we could do it, but, you know, we're just going to let this house burn down so that we can gather this material and go put out other fires later. Wait a minute, you're limiting your authority and power as a fireman to save lives and put out fires to hopefully have some other good to come out of this when you've already said you could make that good happen in another way. Nobody else could get away with intentionally limiting their own power to save somebody for some greater good that they could accomplish in another way. No human being could get away with that. We would fire every one of these people. But when God limits his power, he's worthy of worship?
Well, yes, he is. In fact, he limited himself enough to become Jesus Christ. That is the God we worship, a God who chooses to limit himself. But the point is, David, that, again, what you're setting up here is, A, the divine childminder model of God, and B, a God who can accomplish things without giving us free will. Well, actually, I don't think God can accomplish the most important thing without giving us free will, which is to choose love freely. That you cannot have. It's simply logically impossible to have love without free will. And for me, that is a great enough good for God to choose to limit himself. And I'd agree. Of course, there are, when we're talking about human situations, of course, there are many situations where we don't limit ourselves to allow other people's free will to have free reign. You know, of course, I'm going to stop, someone attacking my child rather than leave them to their free will. But that's because I'm a completely different situation to God. That's not at all the same situation. But there are instances where I will allow free will, even though I could step in. So if my child is learning to ride a bike, I will risk them falling off, but I will still let go of the saddle and let them totter along by themselves. I'm gonna allow the potential of things going wrong at that point, because I think there is some greater good that's going to be accomplished by giving them the freedom to make the mistake or whatever it might be. Now, of course, there are limits to those kinds of analogies, but right. All I'm saying is we're not God has chosen to limit himself to allow a much greater good, that is free will, and which ultimately the greatest good of all, love, is only possible, in my view, because of that choice by God.
So tell me the difference. What would it look like? What's the difference in God being a childminder versus God loving us and keeping us from all harm, as is promised in Psalms 121:7?
Well, I think you have to, you've mentioned Psalms. And yes, of course, that promise exists, but it's within a very you have to take it in conjunction with the whole of Scripture. And I don't think simply pinpointing one particular verse in Psalms in one particular context is a proof for God having some divine mandate to never allow us to come into any harm. I think that God is not the divine childminder, because God is actually a parent. God is and parents will challenge and prod and allow their children freedom, even when sometimes those children will make choices that sadden the parent. You know, that's the whole point, I think, of why God created us. God created us for love, and love has to be freely given and freely received. And we will go against that. That is the nature of free will. And I think it's created a world in which that happens frequently. So for me, God chases us within that. I think God is constantly after us, seeking us down, even through suffering. God can reach us through great things, through joy, through wonderful experiences, but God can also reach us in the midst of great evil and suffering. And so for me, that is just the way God is. That is that the God who brings about his greater good, even through diverse means. There's a Christian philosopher called Alvin Plantinga, and he addresses this issue of the fact that many atheists say, well, couldn't there have been a world in which God could have brought about his purposes with less suffering, less evil, you know? And they're basically asking, do we really live in the best of all possible worlds? And his answer, and I think it is of quite a profound answer, is a world in which God is made flesh, becomes human, and dies in order to redeem the whole of his creation out of in the most supreme act of love. That possibly is the best of all possible worlds because of the kind of good that introduces into the world in a way that is indescribably good.
So Justin, let's move on to, let's do that. Let's move on to free will. You mentioned earlier that God doesn't want to limit himself as to not limit our free will. But I would argue that our free will is limited. I mean, I can get up and walk out of my house, but I can't walk through walls. I can jump, but I can't jump over my house. You know, there are certain things I'm limited from doing just from pure physics. So I don't know. How about, you know, people could die, but as you're dying, you don't feel pain. Or if a kid got sick, they just disappeared and showed up in heaven. They didn't go through 7 months of chemotherapy and constant pain and anguish and then die a slow, miserable death. God could put limits on these types of things, just like he has limited our abilities. I still have the free will to, you know, read the Bible and find it acceptable and then follow Christ, or read the Bible skeptically and turn away from the Bible. I still have that free will without being able to sprout wings and, you know, fly to Jupiter. I'm still limited. So God has already, if God exists, he has already limited our choices to some degree, right?
Yeah, well, I'll put it this way. I think that we live in a world in which, by the nature of how life is, we are limited. It's a kind of a trade-off of the reality of the situation we live in. So, you know, God, you say, well, God could, for instance, you know, ensure that someone who, I don't know, gets stabbed, say, doesn't experience any pain even though they die or something. Well, we live in a world in which we need pain receptors in order to live and to escape from danger and to know when we've been hurt by something. That's the kind of world in which we've been able to develop and become free conscious creatures, and that's the limitations, if you like, of our, so yeah, of course we are limited in all kinds of ways by the nature of the world in which we live. So to some extent, I just think God works within those limitations to bring about his purposes in that sense.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But it's essentially conceding that we don't have complete free will. We have limits. We have certain things we can't choose. If I can't jump over my house, why not also make a world in which pedophilia was off the table? You can still choose to be with God or against God or be an atheist or a Muslim or a Jew or a Christian, but you can't have sex with a child, just like you can't jump over your house. Why not create a world in which that was off the table?
Right. So as I understand it, you're saying if there are physical limits to what we can do because of the nature of the world, gravity and so on, mm-hmm. why doesn't God stop moral things happening? Is that what you're saying? Why doesn't God stop make it impossible for some moral choices to be
made. Yeah, not really.
Is that what you're saying?
Sort of, not really. And I appreciate you attempting to restate my argument in a way that I would agree with. I'm very much in line with Rappaport's rules, and I'm glad you said earlier that you thought I was mischaracterizing your position. At any time, if we need to do that, I think that's the best way to have a fruitful conversation. So I do appreciate you taking time to do this. I wouldn't say stop the things, because that would take us right back to the problem of evil that we were talking about, where God intervenes in every little thing. I'm talking about free will. I'm talking about creating a world in which some things are on the table. I could reach across this table and slap Darius, and he can reach back across the table and slap me. We have that ability, but I don't have the ability to shoot a lightning bolt from my finger into his chest. I that's a limit of my power. I can't do that, right? Mm. So if God has created a world in where I have some choices I could make, I have some choices that are off the table, how about, why didn't he create a world in which raping a four-year-old is not on the table of possibility, or a nine-month-old baby developing leukemia, not on the table? How about you can't get cancer until you're 85 or older? Any of these things could have been put in place. We would still have the free will we have today. But there could be other limitations, like when you drink a certain amount of alcohol, you do not have the ability to turn a key to start a car. You can't drunk drive, right? You still have the choice to get in your car and try and to attempt to do terrible things. You could pick up a frying pan and hit your husband in the head with it. But you can't jump over a building. You can't have sex with a child. You can't get leukemia until you're a certain age. Why didn't God create a world where there are other limitations that would keep some of us safe from others?
I guess you have to take each of those one at a time. I mean, the thing is that the example you give of, well, we can't jump over our house, that is, I don't conceive of that so much as an issue of free will as simply the physical limitations of the world we live in.
Right.
Whereas the choice not to reach over and slap Darius is clearly something within your physical capacity. And therefore, it's a moral choice as to whether you do that or not. Whether I jump over my house, if I had that ability, would still be a moral choice. Would that be the right thing to do or not? But I don't happen to have that option. As you say, it's not on the table.
Yeah, I don't think that's moral. I don't think that would be moral.
Well,
I mean,
it might be. It might be if I was doing it, I don't know, for the wrong reason, or, you know, there could be a moral component to it. But all I'm saying is, I think you're kind of confusing, as I can see it, I could be misrepresenting here, sort of moral choices with things that are just physical limitations.
Well, yeah, but my point is that doesn't matter. My point is that doesn't matter. A physical limitation. Let's just say, why couldn't it be a physical limitation that raping a child is off the table? It's physically impossible to do it.
Because it's not physically impossible to do it, I guess.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Because God didn't create a world in which he wanted that to be a limitation. So God created a world in which we can't jump over buildings, but we can rape children.
But I think we're just going back to the same argument, which is, why doesn't God just stop anything bad happening?
No, you know? Justin, I'm not saying stop it from happening. He created a world. And by the way, he created evil. He created calamity and darkness. He developed all of this to be in our world. He gave us a world in which that evil was possible. He is the one who put pedophilia on the list of things we could do. And he took jumping over houses out of the things we could do. He created a physical limitation, and he allowed other physical things to happen that do harm to innocent children.
Yeah, what he gave is, well, I don't think he created pedophilia. That's the point. I think he created a world in which people can choose to do the wrong things with their bodies. That's the reality. That is what free will is. It's about simply the good gift things God has given us, and whether we choose to use them in the way he intended or not. So for me, it does all go back to the fact that God has given us free will, that there is now, but I don't see that the physical limitation of not being able to jump over my house is just not in the same category as that. I'm sorry if I'm just not following okay. your argument there, David, but I think of that as a, you know, well, so, okay, let's imagine there is some scenario of a world in which, for some physical reason, such, you know, pedophilia was impossible. I'm not exactly sure what that would be. It's hard to conceive of how that could be. But it's, I don't know. I guess again, it's down to the fact that God has instantiated a world in which sexuality exists and okay. people can choose because of their free will. But he's created a world which by its nature means that the limitations of human beings mean they can't jump over houses. But again, I don't know. I'm just having trouble seeing how those are two are kind of equivalent kind of.
Okay. So in a situation where in talking about Darius being across the table from me, if humans did have the ability to shoot lightning bolts from their fingers, and I said, it's crazy. I'm just sitting here waving my hand around and I have the ability to shoot a lightning bolt into Darius's chest from right across the table. And then I say to you, Justin, why would God allow me to do something like that? Why wouldn't he remove the ability of lightning strikes from my hands? You would say, well, that's a moral choice that you're making. Humans do have the ability to shoot electricity from their hands. That's just the world we live in. But God didn't give me that. So he did limit my physical ability to shoot lightning from my hand. He did. I do not have the ability to do that. I have to get some sort of external weapon if I want to fire a projectile across the table, right? So,
sure.
So God has given me that physical limitation. It's not a moral issue. It's a physical world issue. If God created the world, and by the way, I know you said he created a world in which there is the ability to choose evil. If you're familiar with the Bible, Isaiah 45:7 is where God says, I created goodness. I created evil. Some versions say I create calamity, but he says I created evil. I create darkness. I create good. I, the Lord, do all these things. He's bragging about how powerful he is and that he created evil. So if pedophilia is evil, God created pedophilia. If leukemia is evil and calamity, God created leukemia. He didn't just create a world in which children could choose to have cancer. There are kids who are born who are completely innocent, who have made no choices whatsoever, and end up with leukemia. That's not a free will issue. That is an innocent child being stricken with a terrible disease, and humans have to try to come to the aid to reduce the amount of suffering that child has. That kid didn't make a decision to end up there. God could have limited that as a physical impossibility, just as he has limited my ability to shoot electricity from my hands, just as he has limited my ability to jump over my house.
Yeah. The thing is, I think you're setting up false dichotomies here. Firstly, to deal with the issue of the passage from Isaiah, I think calamity is a closer translation, and I don't think it's a claim that God is the originator of evil. I think it's simply making a statement about the fact that God has a level of control in which he can bring about situations. So for me, again, I think you have to take the whole of Scripture into context when you're dealing with that kind of thing. That maybe is a side issue.
Just real quick, the King James Version, the King James Version says, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things.
Yes. But the King James Version is a terrible version. So I would not base your theology on the way that the King James Version translates many passages. But either way, the point you're making is why does God allow things to exist in the world which are not part of people's free will? Why do children have leukemia when it's not there? They've made no free will choice. There's lots of responses that I would give to that. Firstly, a lot of the stuff that happens, the effects of a lot of what happens in the world are still traceable back to some kind of free will. So for instance, if that child has leukemia because some manufacturer put something in the water that their mother drank that gave them the leukemia, there's still obviously a free. So firstly, it's not always a direct response of the person. It's the fact they live in a world where people have free choices. And that's just a scenario. But equally, we might not be able to trace back any kind of particular aspect of free will. And for me, that comes back to what we'd never quite got around to talking about, but this whole kind of cosmic idea that the world is out of kilter, that there's a sense in which the world is not as it should be, and that things happen that are not right. You know, it's not right that kids get leukemia and die. I don't think that's the way the world should be. I don't think God thinks that's the way the world should be. But it's the way the world is at present in its current state. It's what I would call it goes back to what I would call the fall, the fact the world is out of kilter with the way it should be. And for me, Christianity is all about the breaking in of a new kingdom, a new world. And we're going to see that one day ultimately fulfilled. But right now we're in the process of, in tandem with Jesus, bringing in this new world, a world that is, as Paul says, you know, subject to corruption, subject to, you know, the groaning of creation, as he calls it, but which has this hope, this promise of a redemption. So for me, it's all part of that bigger picture, if you like, of a world that is broken, but which God is in the process of fixing.
Well, and that brings us to that cosmic war, and I'm glad you brought that back. This is kind of what I wanted to talk about in that, and it does tie in with free will, in that I don't understand how God could be at war with something he himself created. And I know you like the word calamity over the word evil. So I just grabbed the definition. Calamity is an event causing great and sudden damage or distress, otherwise known as a disaster. And when you look at a thesaurus for calamity, it's disaster, tragedy, cataclysm, catastrophe, collapse, misfortune. So using the word evil interchangeably isn't a stretch. So I think we get caught up in the word evil because it's in the title of the problem of evil. But at the end of the day, calamity and evil, disaster, catastrophe, collapse, misfortune, cataclysm, all of these things tie together that God created them in Isaiah 45:7. It says it. He created calamity. He created evil. And so I don't understand how he could create evil and then limit his powers, give us partial free will, watch us struggle with the calamity he created, not save us from it, and then tell us the reason he's not saving us from it is because he's at war with something he created. It just sounds like such a stretch to try to confirm this preconceived notion or to confirm the bias that God definitely exists and is definitely good. So everything else that happens has to fall within that narrative instead of going, wait a minute, it doesn't make sense that God would create us, love us, also create calamity/evil, allow us to struggle with that evil, and then do nothing to save us from that evil. And then the excuse is, hey, I limited my powers to watch you suffer because I want you to love me. And then your reward in the end is to spend eternity with the guy who could have stopped your suffering and chose not to.
Well, as ever, David, you've taken one verse in Isaiah and spun a huge narrative out of it. And the problem is, I just don't read that verse in the same way as you. I think you're taking it out of context and building a whole theological framework out of it that cannot rest on it. So I think the passage you're talking about in Isaiah, and is it Isaiah 45?
Yes.
That is in the context, as I see it, of him addressing the deliverance of the Israel from Babylon. And I think it's really talking about liberation and captivity and this whole idea of his plans to kind of bring Israel out of that. I don't think it's meant to be understood as some kind of reference to God's ultimate that he has created evil in the way that you obviously want it to be. And I think I take scripture as a whole and I look, and there are lots of other parts of scripture for me which encounter that idea that God is the originator of evil and so on. There are plenty of other scriptures that we could talk about where God is not the author of evil and so on. And so for me, I think just taking one verse and sort of building this whole theology that therefore God is the creator of evil doesn't work for me. And for me, ultimately, you know, the question of, well, why did he create a world in which, you know, bad stuff would happen and that would be his way of redeeming the world? I think God has created freedom, both for us, his humans, and in the spiritual realm. And I think that, you know, I think there's an interesting hint. So I don't think we have a lot of it in scripture, that there is some kind of a kind of a cosmic fall that took place, in which this spiritual rebellion took place. And for me, that's kind of where the stuff happens, and that's why we're in this kind of cosmic warfare, this kind of situation where we are being called to join in with God's kind of redemption of the world. I know that may seem like a kind of strange, crazy idea, probably for the average atheist or skeptic, but for me as a Christian, it's part of a much bigger worldview, which is to say, it's not simply that there's a God and he's basically supposed to keep us safe and then we'll kind of all have a happy life in the afterlife. It's part of a much bigger narrative that's happening in the whole of creation and redemption. And we are joining in with a much bigger story in that sense. So I think when we see suffering, it's not the way the world should be, but it's part of a much bigger story about what has happened and what God is doing to redeem and restore it.
All right, I want to shift gears and get into the rest of the titles. We probably shouldn't have started with the evil thing, because that's, I mean, I don't know. It's an important thing, obviously. It's an important thing to discuss. I don't know, a lot of people are going to be interested in it. But I want to shift gears and get into a few more chapter titles. But first, if you're looking to buy a car, you're probably familiar with terms like MSRP. You might even know what it stands for. But what does it actually mean? Well, the same goes for invoice, list price, and dealer price. It's enough to confuse anybody. All you're really looking for is a price that actually means something. Introducing True Price from True Car. Now you can know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, before you even get to the dealership. How cool is that? So, True Car dealers will show you the true price on cars like the one you want, all from the comfort of your home. But how do you know if your true price is a great price? Well, it's because True Car shows you what other people paid for that same car you want. And your certified dealers know this is going to happen, so they set their true price competitively so they can win your business. So when you're ready to buy, new or used, visit True Car to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states. Now, you've got a chapter title in here, Justin, in which you talk about your 10 minutes with Richard Dawkins. I would love to know what happened. Richard was on my show. We sat in L.A. at one point. I went to his hotel and took sort of my mobile recording gear, and it's been one of my more popular shows. He was great to talk to. He's a really smart guy, really fun. I'm curious, though, how did you get 10 minutes with him, and what happened?
Well, I've actually had, over the course of the shows, more than 10 minutes with him, which is nice. Okay. But the 10 minutes really refers to my first time I engaged with him. This was maybe 2 or 3 years into the show having started. And the show really began around the time that The God Delusion came out, which, of course, is Richard Dawkins' best-selling book on the case against God and for atheism. And it was not long after the show launched that book was published, and his name really started to come up a lot in the shows that I was doing with different skeptics and Christians. And so I really wanted to have him on the show, obviously, such a big name. And I requested via the publisher and so on to get him on a number of times. It was never working out and so on. And then eventually he was due to have a debate with John Lennox, Professor John Lennox in Oxford. I got invited to the debate, and I went along, and they had a great debate in the Natural History Museum at Oxford University. And then afterwards, there was a sort of after show kind of thing going on at a nearby college. And again, I'd fortunately been given an invitation to attend this. So I thought, okay, maybe I'll get a chance to talk to him at last. I'd brought my mobile recording stuff with me, in order to maybe be able to grab an interview with him. But the funny thing was, as I walked out of the museum where the debate had taken place, who should pull up next to me, trundling his bicycle along, but Richard Dawkins himself, as we were walking down the road. And so I said, oh, hello, Richard. I just watched the debate. It was really great. And we had a kind of a chat on the way to this this after show reception. And he was a little bit sort of, I'm glad you enjoyed it. When I told him I worked for a Christian radio station, he was a little bit skeptical of that. But he was nice and friendly. And I said, I'd love to get a conversation with you maybe once we're inside. And I did manage to. It was one of those bustling environments with lots going on, you know, canapes and champagne and everything else. And there were lots of other people who obviously wanted his attention. But I did manage to eventually get my 10 minutes with him in the midst of this bustling reception. And and we just had a really good conversation covering some of the points that he'd raised in the debate with John Lennox. I played out the interview on a show later on. What was interesting, though, was that part of the conversation we had started to do the rounds on a number of blogs. Because he said something quite interesting. He made an interesting admission, and it was interesting enough for me to include it in the book. I don't know if you've time, I'll read out the this part of our conversation.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
And so we kind of talked about a number of different things, and at one point in our conversation I sort of asked him whether we can really believe that morality is derived just from a sort of godless, undirected process of evolution alone. And I began this by asking him, but if we'd evolved into a society where rape was considered fine, would that mean that rape is fine? And he replied, well, I don't want to answer that question. It's enough for me to say that we live in a society where it's not considered fine. We live in a society where selfishness, failure to pay your debts, failure to reciprocate favors is regarded askance. That is the society in which we live. I'm very glad, that's a value judgment, glad that I live in such a society. And I responded, but when you make a value judgment, don't you yourself immediately step outside this evolutionary process and say that the reason this is good is that it's good, and you don't have any way to stand on that statement? And he replied, well, my value judgment itself could come from my evolutionary past. And I said, so therefore, it's just as random in a sense as any product of evolution. And he said, you could say that. In any case, nothing about it makes it more probable that there's anything supernatural. And I finished by saying, okay, but ultimately, your belief that rape is wrong is as arbitrary as the fact that we've evolved five fingers rather than six. And he said, you could say that, yeah. And then the conversation kind of moved on. But a lot of people kind of picked that up and said, and in a sense, I think it was quite a significant admission, because I think he is being consistent with his worldview there, that if there is no ultimate direction, you know, morality is just the product, the happenstance of the hand we're dealt by evolution, then it is hard to say that rape is wrong. It's just the way we've evolved to think. It's as arbitrary as any other factor of evolution. And for me, I think that's an important thing for me as a Christian, because I think it does reveal a significant difference between the Christian worldview and the naturalistic worldview, which is that there is a moral dimension to the Christian worldview. There is a, you know, it's often called an objective moral realm, a realm of values and duties that we are subject to. And I don't think that can exist on a naturalistic worldview. And it's hard to, in that sense, to understand why we do have this moral sense, this impetus, this belief in the intrinsic dignity and value of humans, why some things really are right and wrong, if that's not actually the way things are in reality, if that's just an illusion that's been foisted on us by evolution. So that was kind of an interesting sort of little interaction with Dawkins that stayed with me.
Okay. I talked with him a little bit about that, actually, not his conversation with you, but specifically I brought up this idea with him that, and I said, I have this argument and I want to run it by you. I want to know what you think. And he was like, okay, well, let me hear it. And I sort of laid out this idea that when we're talking about human morality, what we do is we're really comparing human flourishing versus human harm. And we don't really need a, that really is the moral standard, is the human flourishing versus human harm. And obviously, there's going to be a bias there, right? It's going to be, well, I'm a rapist. I like to rape. So if I'm doing harm to a human, I'm flourishing in my own right. So I get to do it. But in order to remove that bias, the mechanism by which to determine right from wrong is Rawls' veil of ignorance. So if you put someone behind the veil of ignorance, it doesn't suddenly make it subjective. It does, though, say you don't know if you're going to be the rapist or if you're going to be the victim. So tell me if rape is okay. And then it's objective at that point to say, obviously, we can now review the facts of reality with the bias removed by putting up the veil. And so with the bias removed, you can honestly answer the question, is rape doing more harm or conducive to human flourishing? Well, obviously, it's not conducive to human flourishing. It's definitely doing harm to a person, holding them down and forcing them to do things. The person behind the veil, who is the rapist, not knowing if they're going to be the rapist or if they're going to have to be the victim of that rape, can certainly tell they wouldn't want the rape to happen to them. So I presented this argument to Richard, and he actually told me it was a really good argument, and he loved it. I don't remember exactly his words, but I felt super confident that I was going to move forward with that, and I did leverage that again in my debate this past week on the Non Sequitur show, which was really effective. I think that's the way to move forward. Mm. I think the veil of ignorance is a really good mechanism. Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting argument, and I remember studying Rawls at philosophy, you know, at undergraduate level, and I appreciate the power of that argument. I think there's a couple of issues for me with it, which is that it is, in a sense, a hypothetical, and the reality is that people in the real world, as it were, are in a position of power. They don't have to abide by that. I suppose the question is, why should I abide by a hypothetical, given that I am not actually in that position of being behind the veil of ignorance? There's still a question of why we should do the thing that we would do in that circumstance, if that makes sense. So I think there is still a moral question at the heart of it. The second problem is, I've always felt that Rawls' veil of ignorance basically turns upon self-interest. That's the essential thing that is at the bottom of it. Personal self-interest. If I, not knowing what situation I will be born into in the world, cannot know, then I will choose a world in which I will have the best possible opportunity in whichever sphere I find myself in, and that's kind of the basis on which we say, well, that's the world we should enact then. It's still, though, interestingly, it's still based on my personal preferences. If the veil of ignorance wasn't there, I would choose the best for me. You know, I would just, you know, it's still based on essentially self-interest, and for me, that still leaves the question of, is that the best basis on which we base our morality if it's still ultimately based on selfishness?
Hold on. Why would it be self-interest? Because what I'm getting at is, it allows you, the veil of ignorance allows you to remove the bias so that you can review the facts of reality. It's not a matter of subjective opinion. If you hold down a baby and start cutting into their arm, that causes pain, and that cutting into a person's arm is not conducive to flourishing. So that's just a fact of reality. It's a matter of physics and you know, observable reality. You know what I'm saying? So it's not like, well, I don't think that the baby's hurting. No, it's a matter of reality. But for someone to say, but I enjoy torturing babies. Oh, okay. I get that. Now let's put you behind the veil of ignorance. You don't know if you're going to be the person with the knife or if you're going to be the baby. That removes the bias and allows you to see the facts of reality without your biased perception. So it's a fact of reality. It's not about self-interest.
Well, it is a fact of reality, obviously, that, you know, doing something like that, causes pain. But the point is, if you're asking the rapist or the baby killer or whatever it is to stand behind the veil of ignorance, you're essentially saying to them, as I see it, as I've interpreted rules, you will act out of your own self-interest to put yourself into a world where you will not, you're at the least, have the least chance of being in the position of the baby rather than the other way around or whatever. And that applies obviously to all kinds of things, you know, the way we order the world in terms of justice and social equality and everything else. The problem is, as I say, I understand what you're saying, that kind of, I think what you're saying is it removes the bias. It removes the kind of, it puts you in the position of choosing the thing that is going to be the best for you if you don't know which of those situations you're going to be in. But it's still, for me, that still turns on the issue of self-interest. It's still my, because I don't know whether I will be this, that, or the other, I'm going to choose a situation in the world, the way the world should be set up, to be a situation where I'll have the best chance in any given situation. As I say, it may be a good way of establishing what a system of justice. And I'm not saying it isn't. It might be a really good way of doing that and deciding what the best way to run the world is. But it still turns on ultimately this idea of a selfishness and a self-interest. And for me, that's the problem is you can't get away from and it still doesn't answer the problem of the shouldness of right and wrong. It's not, I don't think rules sort of way of looking at it kind of takes away the fact that there's a moral imperative about why we should adopt that particular system of justice. Does that follow?
Yes. I just want to make it clear one more time, and I don't want to keep having this. I don't want to go, you know, cyclical with it, but I will say, it does get confusing because I don't want it to be, about the actual choice of the situation. It's that a lot of times one's bias prevents them from seeing the facts of reality. So they're like, yeah, I understand this person's going to be hurt by this, but I really want this because I'm me and I have this bias in this world and this perception and this viewpoint or whatever. The veil of ignorance is not so that one can make a subjective decision. The veil of ignorance in my argument that I've set up is to remove the bias so that you can clearly see the facts of reality. That's all I'm getting at. And then, and then once you can review the situation, the simple question is this in favor of human flourishing, or is this doing harm, unnecessary harm that's not going to result in more human flourishing? This becomes objective for me. It's an objective basis. Now, I will say not every moral decision comes down to this. There are moral decisions that are subjective. Should you run the stop sign at 3 o'clock in the morning? There's no objective yes or no to that. There's not an inherent yes or no. It's just a sign on a planet that, you know, that police or that the city has set up. There's no inherently moral wrong of running a stop sign. You know what I mean? It's a rule that's been set up that's arbitrary based on our traffic laws. So not everything is like that. Should you return the $5 that you find? Well, if you see the person drop it, I think we have a separate situation. And if you just find a random $5 bill, yeah, should you go turn it in? Perhaps. But what if the person you turn it into keeps it and they become dishonest? So maybe you could do something good with that $5 and donate it to someone instead of giving it to someone who may steal it. So that, you know, not every situation is going to come down to an absolute objective yes or no. Like a lot of times people bring up the dentist. They'll say, is it okay to stab a child in the mouth? And then you say, no. Okay. Well, so a dentist is morally wrong. No, if you take that if you run it through my veil of ignorance, and weigh it of human flourishing versus human harm, the shot in the child's mouth or the shot in the person's mouth, it does do harm, but it has a greater outcome of human flourishing because you're still minimizing further stress that could come, right? So even if you run that through, it still comes out as, you know, morally good to give a person a shot of an anesthetic. So it's not about put yourself behind the veil and make a choice. It's put yourself behind the veil to remove the bias so that you can honestly answer without bias. Is this in favor of human flourishing or does it cause harm? That's the final point I wanted to make before we moved on to the next.
Well, I appreciate you because I think this is a really interesting response to the moral argument. And it's one I want to explore more actually, because I haven't heard that many people using it, but my initial, without really having thought about it all that much, in all honesty, my initial two thoughts are this. Firstly, I think there's a question about why we choose human flourishing as the baseline for what is desirable, because I think that in itself is an assumption about the way the world is and should be. Why don't we choose some other thing as the essential thing that is the oughtness about life, like, I don't know, the flourishing of the ant world or something like that? Why do we preference ourselves over any other kind of flourishing? But let me just finish the thought. So there's that question of why is it us? And the second question is, you can do the thought experiment and you can say, put yourself behind the veil of ignorance. What would you choose? Okay, you would choose not to, you know, to enact a world in which these bad things don't happen. Okay. The question then is, if you present that as the reason why the person should not do that thing to the baby, you're saying you should act according to the way you would want the world to be if you were behind the veil of ignorance. There's still a moral demand upon that person that the way they conduct their life should be in concordance with the way that they would choose things if they were behind the veil of ignorance. And the problem is, I don't see that it stops there being a kind of moral demand. This kind of the oughtness of the thing is still there, and I don't see why someone should do that. If we live in a completely naturalistic universe, even if you can show someone that logically they should be enacting a world that they would prefer in the veil of ignorance, I still don't see why that somehow then becomes that becomes a duty of theirs, a moral duty, in a world without God. It's just, they can just say, no, don't want to, you know, I know that's what I should, that's what I would do in that situation, but that's not where I actually find myself. So I'm not going to bother. And that's the point. It's like, there's this kind of, it's where does the oughtness of following the logic of rules is argument.
That's a huge, huge conversation. And I want to get to other titles in your other chapter titles in your book. But I will say that I give a talk called The Happy Obligation of Humanism. And that is a big focus of my next book that I've been working on, is that because there is no God out there watching over us, or if he is, he certainly doesn't seem to care about us enough to save us from the harm, then humanists do have an obligation. And then they say, well, hold on. We go back to David Hume. We go back to the is-ought problem. How do you get an ought from an is? I dive into that and I think I make a good case, but it's not something I could get into fast enough to have a quick conversation with you and then move
on.
But we could have you back on specifically to talk about that, maybe when my book comes out or whatever. We could get into
and,
that.
And I'd love to get you on to talk about the rules thing, because I think that's one of the most interesting responses I've heard to the moral argument. So good on
awesome.
You, David.
Awesome. No, thank you. And I've sort of pieced that together from several different people. A little bit of Sam Harris. I've talked with a little bit of Matt Dillahunty about it. I did a debate in which Peter Boghossian helped me prepare for a debate with Matt Slick, and I sort of combined several different of these arguments along with my own private research to sort of build this concept that I think makes a pretty good argument for at least an objective moral standard from an atheist perspective. So I hope it makes sense to folks, and I'd love to come on your show and specifically talk
I think
about
it's I would say I think it's a better argument than Sam Harris's one in the moral landscape, because I'm not aware that he made that kind of an argument in the moral landscape.
No, he didn't.
And I think the problem with Sam Harris and with many atheists who try to get a kind of an objectiveness out of a naturalistic world is that they have to make an assumption at some point. about things. And he obviously makes it at this kind of, you know, the bedrock is the,
well,
this, what he calls human flourishing.
But and to be perfectly clear, I think where my argument starts to have issues is when you apply it to either abortion or when you apply it to eating animals.
Yeah,
because vegans have pulled me aside after a debate who are also atheists and go, I love this objective moral argument you make about the veil of ignorance. What if you were the pig? You know what I mean? And I'm, you know,
no, completely.
So yeah. And
that's, and that's what I mean about the privileging of the human flourishing, I suppose, is why that rather than any other form of life.
Right. And that's, well, that's why I'm very, very clear to say human morality, human flourishing, and human suffering. But I'm still wrapping up the ends on it as I'm writing this book. So I'm confident that I'll be able to work this through and get it to a solid argument. So,
well, I'd love to read that when it's ready. So yeah, definitely.
Fantastic. Awesome. I want to talk to you real quick about, you have three chapter titles that are sort of similar, and I figured we could probably put them into one conversation. Chapter two is called God Makes Sense of Human Existence. Chapter three is God Makes Sense of Human Value. And chapter four is God Makes Sense of Human Purpose. So talk about the differences for a moment between purpose, value, and existence. And how does God make sense of any of those?
Well, I'll try and do it as quickly as I can. So existence, really, what I'm referring to there is really, it's an excuse to talk about the way in which we have come about in this universe. The fact that we exist is in a way miraculous. And that's where I go into the fact of the fine tuning of the universe that enables life to exist. And the fact that there is a universe, you know, the cosmological arguments and so on. And so all I'm trying to do there is what I'm trying to do in all three of those chapters is to say, here are some things that we all agree on. We exist, we have value, and there is purpose. Or we may not agree on those, but most people seem to recognize that these things exist. And what's the best explanation for these things? Is it the Christian worldview or the naturalistic worldview? So when I've generally said, you know, obviously not all atheists are naturalists, because some atheists are simply just haven't thought about it that much. But most atheists who are thinking atheists that I know tend to subscribe to some form of naturalism, that all that ultimately exists is matter, emotion, energy, and so on. And all I'm trying to do in each of those chapters is say, what makes best sense of the fact of human existence? What makes best sense of the sense that people have of the intrinsic value and dignity of human beings? What makes best sense of the ultimate sense of purpose and hope that humans aspire to? And in each case, I make the argument that Christianity is a better explanation of that. God is a better explanation of those things than naturalism is. And so in the case of human existence, I make the case that the nature of the universe, the fine tuning, the cosmology, the fact that we can do science at all, that we live in a universe that is explicable in mathematical terms, is more consonant with theism, with God, than with naturalism, on which it's all a massive fluke. That's a very brief, we can obviously go into discussing and debating that. Human value. That's what we've kind of just been talking about, this question of where does this sense that most people seem to have, that humans have intrinsic value and dignity? Why do we create, you know, Universal Declaration of Human Rights? What's the basis for that? I can see a clear basis for it in the Christian worldview, that humans are made in the image of God. That gives them ultimate value. I struggle to see any particular reason why we would have that belief in an objective intrinsic value of humans on a naturalistic worldview, when we are simply just another product or in a unpurposed process of evolution. And finally, the purpose thing is that's a little bit different, because that's where I'm saying we see this this longing across all times, cultures, and places for something beyond this material world, for something transcendent. What explains that? Is it just, you know, again, an illusion foisted on us by our evolutionary history? Or could there be something that actually meets that desire? It's what C.S. Lewis called the argument from desire, where he said, you know, we find in all the rest of our experience in life, you know, that we have things that meet our desires, you know, We feel thirsty. Well, there is such a thing as water. We have sexual desires. Well, there is such a thing as sex. And if we find in ourselves a desire which nothing in this world can satisfy, it means that we're made for a different world. And the point he's making is we see this desire for transcendent, for more, for ultimate purpose, ultimate meaning, ultimate hope. And could it be that that also has is also met in something? And I believe it is, obviously, in Jesus Christ. So again, all I'm trying to do in those is kind of put two different ways of looking at the world side by side, naturalism and theism and Christianity, and saying what makes best sense. And in my view, Christianity makes better sense of those aspects of our experience.
So what is the meaning of human life?
Well, I would say if you're asking what the meaning of human life is, I think to know God and to be known. Or to love God and to be loved. That would be, in a nutshell, what I would say is the meaning and purpose of life.
So I really hate to keep tying it back to the problem of evil. I really don't want to, but every time we get into a conversation about God, that's what I keep thinking about.
Sure.
So let me ask then. God, we have this situation, Justin, in which God could have just, you know, he could have created us in heaven where there is no evil, but we have some sort of free will. Right? This idea that we get to be with God all the time. We know he exists. He's right there. We're keeping him company. We love him. He's our creator. Everything's great. But he didn't create that. He created a world in which there is evil and calamity. And we have terrible things we suffer through. We have, like I said, cancer and tornadoes and disasters and murder and rape and all these terrible things. But if the entire purpose of human life, if the meaning of life is to know God and be known, then none of this suffering was necessary. He didn't need to send us to Earth first to go through all of these terrible things in order to love him. He could have created us as angels in heaven, still given us the will to leave heaven if we wanted to. We could turn against God if we chose. We could have the free will to leave, but to know him, to be known, and to love him with free will, but without evil, just like in heaven. If the whole meaning of life is to love God and to know God and to be known by God, everything that happens on earth, every bad thing that happens, is completely unnecessary or gratuitous.
Well, again, it depends, I think, on the perspective that you look at it from. And obviously, my statement to know and be known, or to love and be loved by God, is encapsulating a very wide variety of possible experiences, you know. And as I say, what if the best of all possible worlds is one in which God can demonstrate his love in the most extraordinary way possible by actually dying for his creation? That's one way in which that love could be expressed in the most extraordinary way possible. That might mean a world in which we can choose to go against him, in which corruption and evil and everything else happens. We can always try and second guess God and say, oh God, you know, you should have done it this way. That would have made a lot more sense if it's just about us coming to know and love you. But I think there are ways in which there may be purposes that we simply cannot see, ways in which God is creating a much deeper, richer, more meaningful kind of love through a world where bad things happen, you know.
Yeah, I understand. But he could.
So we're kind of going back.
Yeah. And we could have the same conversation where then I say, well, yeah, he could have created that deeper meaning love by snapping his fingers. He doesn't have to make us go through car accidents to love him. And, you know, we could go back. But let me ask you, do you believe that there is no evil in heaven, right?
Well, I don't really know much about what heaven is going to be like, to be honest. I think in the spiritual dimension, I think it's possible for people, for, you know, spiritual creations to turn against God. That's kind of the story of the cosmic fall, in a way. But I think that it depends what you mean by heaven. What I assume you're meaning is the world to come, for me, that is a redeemed, restored, renewed world. And I think that world will in some way be an outworking of the world we live in. I don't exactly know how that's going to work, what kind of a world that will look like, but I believe it's a restored, renewed creation. So I think God created, and God, when he recreates, all the things that we've been through will in some way be bound up in that creation, in the final redemption. And so if that world is a world in which there is no more suffering and no more evil, I think it'll some way be related to the fact we have been through a world in which that has happened. There'll be a kind of a sense in which that reality has been contingent on our reality now.
Yeah.
So there's a sense in which I'm not sure you can have that promised new creation without the creation that preceded it, if that makes sense.
Well, doesn't God have the ability to have us born with pre-installed memories of things that have happened?
Well, I guess so, but then it's an illusion. It's not real. That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think God wants something real. I would rather live in a world of where it's a genuine recreation rather than simply God just created me 2 minutes ago with a lot of false memories.
That's interesting. So would you rather live in a world in which all of these terrible evil things happen, or in a world where you were born into heaven, know God immediately and love him forever without having to suffer?
Well, again, I trust that God is bringing about the best kind of world for me to live in all honesty. And that it may be that a world in which Jesus Christ died for us is that world. That's the kind of the point of it. I don't know, you know, you're asking how can I possibly know whether I would have been better off in a heaven, you know, being born into a heaven where I instantly knew God and so on. There are so many factors of what it is to be human and to know God that may not be possible in such a scenario. So it's kind of, you know, it's impossible to say at one level, but in a sense, my feeling is that the problem of suffering is a problem for me. Okay. I think there's lots of evidence for God, for Christianity. And the major argument against it is the problem of suffering, which is why we quite rightly keep coming back to it.
Yeah.
But for me, as much as it presents a problem, and there are things where I might ask exactly the same question, David, God, couldn't you have done it differently? Couldn't you have done it? There's enough on the positive side, which makes me accept the mystery of the problem of suffering and to reconcile myself to the fact that it is possible for God to work even in this kind of a world and to produce the best of all possible worlds, even so, in which the greatest amount of love and goodness and knowledge of him is created. So it's but to some extent, yeah, that is an article of faith in a sense. It's saying I'm trusting in the God I know for the things I don't know. It's saying the problem of suffering is a really hard problem. And I'm not trying to make light of it and just, you know, come up with some clever argument which does away with it. All I'm doing is I'm trying to grapple with it and say, given that I find so many plausible reasons for Christianity to be true from my own experience and from history and what I see around me, human experience, this issue I think is resolvable. I think there's a way of coming to terms with it.
So let's move into your chapter 6, which is facts that only fit the resurrection. Take me through some of those, because I can just tell you right off, my primary objection, anytime someone starts to tell me about facts about the resurrection, I immediately just say, we don't get to call them facts. So I already disagree with your chapter title. this is, you know, passed down information that were either, you know, some sort of creed or memorization that was passed down for quite some time and then written in an original language and then translated multiple times that had countless unknown scribes as a part of it. We can't verify that this information is true, yet many people will say Jesus resurrected as a fact. people will say Jesus appeared to 500 people as a fact, and that Jesus ascended into heaven as a fact, or that he put his hand, he proved to Thomas that he was the resurrected Christ as a fact. And I don't know that we get to call those facts. So how did you determine what facts fit the resurrection, and how do you support that claim?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's a question of terminology at some level. I use the word facts in relation to what's often called the minimal facts hypothesis. And I'm sure you're probably familiar with that, David. But I don't speak of facts in that sense, in the way that we might talk of a mathematical fact, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. Obviously, in historical terms, facts are always at some level held, you know, with some degree of skepticism, because not some, you know, we could always be proved wrong. You know, it could be that, in fact, you know, World War II didn't happen and there was just some huge, you know, collusion to make us all think that it did or whatever. But nonetheless, historians obviously have at some level a sort of a level at which, within their genre, within their time frame, they're willing to call something a fact if it passes a certain degree of certainty, let's say. And so the question is, are there things from within the origin story of Christianity which qualify as facts? And I'm really borrowing from the argument that people like Gary Habermas and Mike Lacona have developed here, which is to say, well, surveying those who are the experts in this field, both believing and non-believing scholars of New Testament history, what are the things that the vast majority of those scholars, whether believing or non-believing, are agreed upon? Obviously, there are lots of contested areas, things where a smaller number of people agree on whether this part of the Gospels is reliable and whether that is, or whatever. But what's interesting is they've come up with 4 or 5, and some people have 6 or 7 areas, facts which the vast majority of scholars, believing or non-believing, believe can qualify essentially as facts, as things we know, you know, within the kind of scope of what we can know historically happened. And those are things like the crucifixion of Jesus.
Wait, how do we know that happened?
Well, because it's as established a fact as many other things in ancient history that we are happy to say happened. You know, the crossing of the Rubicon by Caesar is an established historical fact. The crucifixion of Jesus has way more evidence for it in terms of the historical record than that event does. So we're entitled to kind of give it the same weight, in fact, more than the crossing of the Rubicon by Caesar. So there, it's just the way you do history. It's kind of what the level of kind of the weight of evidence that goes in the direction of something, if that makes sense. And so when you survey those who are, you know, this is their area, these are what, you know, commonly seen as the minimal facts, the things that the vast majority of scholars, believing and non-believing, say are, you know, pretty much beyond dispute, that Jesus died by crucifixion, that the followers of Jesus reported that they had met him in risen form, the conversion of certain skeptics, and the explosive growth of the Christian church. Those are 4 of the facts that I use in this this one. There's another one, which is the empty tomb, the record of the empty tomb. That's and Habermas is clear that that's not as widely accepted across the believing and non-believing sphere. So he actually often leaves that out of his list of minimal facts. But even without it, I think you have a very interesting list of the you know, things, historical events that are agreed on by the majority of believing and non-believing scholars in the area. And so all I try to do in this chapter is say, okay, if these are the things that the historians say we're happy to agree on, what's the best explanation for them? And for me, the explanation that the first followers gave, that Jesus Christ rose again, is the best explanation of these facts. I think other explanations are much harder to reconcile all those different facts together.
Well, okay, so Caesar crossing the Rubicon, Jesus being crucified, all of these things may fit into similar categories. But once you get into a dead person coming back to life, you've reached a new level of extraordinary claims that any other ancient myth that makes claims of gods or miracles can be debunked by just saying we know that can't happen. There are statements in the Bible that the sun froze in the sky for a long period of time. We know that can't happen. That would cause chaos on the earth, right? So there are all sorts of issues like that where I say, yeah, okay, you can compare a person named Yeshua living at the time, you know, that this book was written. Sure, I'm sure that happened. Was he Jesus the Christ? I don't know that we have evidence for that. Was a guy killed? I mean, Apollonius of Tyana claimed to be the Messiah. There were hundreds of people claiming to be the Messiah. So sure, there are, you know, a guy named Josh who said he was a Messiah. Why not? Yeah, I mean, that's not an issue. But once you – that can hold about as much weight as Caesar crossing the Rubicon or Alexander the Great conquering some nation. These things really don't matter as much. But when you get into a claim like – this man died and then came back to life after 3 days, and then his body literally floated upward into the sky, levitated, and then floated and then disappeared. Now you've made such an extraordinary claim that you don't get to use the same evidence, you know, of Caesar crossing the Rubicon or Alexander the Great or a guy named Josh living and claiming to be the Messiah like Apollonius of Tyana. Now you've made such an extraordinary claim, you're required to provide extraordinary evidence to match that.
Well, I think that's a logical fallacy, actually. This idea that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, I don't think that follows. I mean, if I make the claim that I've won the lottery, that's an extraordinary claim. But I don't need to provide extraordinary evidence. I just need to produce the lottery ticket.
I don't think that's an extraordinary claim that you've won the lottery. It's just a claim. There's nothing.
It's a pretty extraordinary claim, you know, that I, out of millions of people in the UK, have won the lottery. That's quite an extraordinary claim.
Okay. Yeah. No. I see what you're saying. It's extraordinary
because it's extremely unlikely. It's extremely unlikely that I will have won the lottery.
Yeah, extremely unlikely, but not impossible.
I don't have to do anything extraordinary to prove it. I just have to produce a lottery ticket. I don't think that the logic. I've never quite followed the logic of this idea that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. I just think that's a bit of a saying, and it doesn't really have much logical weight to it.
I think you brought up a good point with the lottery because it's extremely rare, but it's not impossible. And when we talk about extraordinary claims, we're talking about things that we know are impossible. It is impossible for a man to ascend and levitate, defy the laws of physics.
Who's decided that it's impossible for
No one has to decide that. Physics decided that. People don't die, stay dead for 3 days and come back to life. Nobody levitates and floats upward. It's astronomically impossible for that to happen. It's not just rare, like winning the lottery. So I think we come down to how we define the word extraordinary. Sure, extraordinary. It is out of the ordinary to win the lottery. Technically, you have a point, but it's not on the same plane of a man dying, coming back to life after 3 days in a tomb, and then floating up to the heavens. That's not on the same level.
Let's leave the ascension to one side, because all that this argument is dealing with is the resurrection. But the point is that I think what you've decided is that miracles don't happen. It's impossible. Therefore, of course, I could never, if that's the case, David, that miracles don't happen, then of course I could never produce any kind of evidence, no matter how extraordinary, to show that it happened. Because if it can't happen, if it's logically impossible, then of course I could never ever produce the evidence that would convince you of that. So I suppose my question to you is there any evidence that could convince you that a man rose from the dead?
I don't know, but I know that whatever it is that would convince me, God knows that and hasn't showed it to me.
Okay. But as it stands, you can't think of any evidence that could convince you that a man rose from the dead.
I mean, a man. I mean, I guess we could get generic and it could. I mean, I don't know. I mean, my whole point in this is that if you look at someone like, you take something like a police report, or no, not a police report. Let's say an arrest record. If the arrest record said, oh, this guy was picked up for robbing a 7-Eleven, okay. This guy was arrested for beating his wife, okay. You believe those things. They're in his arrest record, and you're looking at this official document from the state that says he had this arrest and here's what he did. Sure, you could go investigate each individual claim and find evidence of each one, but you don't really need to. You trust that because it's a pretty basic claim about this guy's history. He's got a rap sheet 7 pages long. You see all of his crimes. If somewhere in there it said he once evaded police by floating over their heads, landing on Lake Michigan, and then sprinting across the top of the water, you'd probably go, somebody's messing with me. Somebody's joking. This document now becomes in question of its credibility because it's made such an extraordinary claim. So yes, if you want me to believe that extraordinary claim that we know is impossible, you need to bring more evidence than just he robbed a 7-Eleven.
Sure. And I agree. I mean, unusual claims, obviously you're going to want to see some evidence for them because they're unusual, you know. If it's out of the ordinary, you know, nature of what happens in life, you're obviously going to want to see some evidence. But it wouldn't necessarily be extraordinary evidence you'd need to see if that really did happen to that man, that he floated across the water or something. You'd need to say to the officer, did you see, you know, find the witness who with no gain to themselves says it happened, I saw it happen. You know, and if that person has no reason to be lying, no reason to be making that up, maybe you've got to entertain the possibility that.
Well, no, because
happened. There's a naturalistic explanation for it. It may be that, oh, there was the, what he couldn't see was that there was a speedboat underneath him or something else. Who knows?
Yeah.
But the point is, you know, we have to go to evidence, you know, and the point I was trying to make earlier, really, in asking what kind of evidence could convince you, and you saying, well, I can't really think of any, maybe God knows, is that I think you have an a priori objection. You live in a world in which God does not exist, therefore.
But that's not where I started, Justin. Stop. That's not where I started. It's not fair for you to say that I live in a world in which I have this bias and this a priori notion that God doesn't exist, and so that's my world. That's not where I started. I started where you are. I started wanting to resolve these problems because I was a Christian and I wanted to help other people come to the faith. And you or I being incapable of coming up with a reason as to why these people may have lied doesn't suddenly make them honest. Me looking at a book and going, well, I can't figure out why this guy would have lied, therefore it's true. That's just a logical fallacy. That's not the way truth works. So I didn't start in a world in where God doesn't exist and I'm just out to disprove his existence. I was in your camp and I was trying to make sense of this. And even in a Christian worldview, I kept finding pieces of the wall falling away. I can't justify bad things happening. I can't justify a dead guy coming back to life. I don't think there's enough evidence. I don't think passed down creeds and chants that were then written down in a language I don't read and then translated into multiple languages. And now we have 40-something thousand, you know, different schisms and breaks off here and there. And all these different versions of the Bible, Christians will argue this is the best. The New World Translation, the NIV, the King James Version's terrible. How do we know which one is which? But it's all considered to be God's word. Every bit of this started to fall away from me, from the ascension to heaven, to Jesus' body not being found, to him dying and coming back to life. And then some of the forgeries in the Bible, some of the things that were added later as far as the story of Daniel or Jesus laying hands on, or Jesus walking up and saying, he who has never sinned, cast the first stone. We know that didn't really happen at the time. That was added later. All these things started to fall apart for me. And then I went, you know what? There are so many holes in this. I can't say I believe it anymore. I want to keep searching for the truth and talk to people who do believe it, but I can no longer defend this because there are so many holes. So no, I didn't start in a world where God exists and I have this a priori bias that I'm trying to confirm all the time. I got tired of trying to defend the indefensible.
Okay. Well, I get that's your story, David. And in a sense, I've looked at all the same stuff as you. All of those are issues that I'm very familiar with. But I've come to a different conclusion, and I've come to the conclusion that they are resolvable and that actually the preponderance of evidence is on the side of Christianity rather than against it. Now, obviously, we're all looking at the same evidence and just coming to different conclusions, and that may just be the way life is sometimes. All I was trying to say, I wasn't trying to say that you haven't gone through a period, obviously, of assessing, you know, from within the Christian worldview and finding it wanting. But it seemed to me that what you were saying from where you stand now is that miracles are by definition impossible. Therefore, Jesus did not rise from the dead. Now, of course, if that's your worldview, if that's where you are now, then no amount of evidence will convince you that Jesus rose from the dead because it's logically impossible. But if we actually live in a world where there is a God and he can do miraculous things, if that's an open possibility, then I find the explanation that Jesus rose from the dead as to be a very compelling explanation of those different historical facts. If we're simply not allowed miracles, then of course it has to be, there has to be a naturalistic explanation. They were mistaken. It's not the way it looked like, whatever it is, you know, maybe something else happened to the body. All of that stuff has some version of that has to be true if miracles can't happen. But if it's possible there's a God, then I think Jesus rising from the dead, that is the best explanation. It simply is, in my view, the best explanation if it's possible that miracles happen. I also think it's tied into the fact that it happened to this particular man who fulfilled a whole number of aspects of prophecy from the Jewish tradition and whose life has basically been the linchpin on which moral, so the whole of Western democracy and morality has kind of hung on, and his words are still revered. And there's something about this person to whom this claimed event happened that is also significant. It's not just that some random person claimed to have risen from the dead. It's that this person who claimed to be the Messiah of Israel and who has continued to be the most influential person in the world is the person for whom this event is claimed to have happened. And I think that's significant as well. It's not just that some people claim that someone raised from the dead. So all I'm saying is, if you're not prepared to concede the possibility of a miracle, then I totally get that you, no evidence would be enough. But if
I never said that, I never said that no evidence would be enough. I just said I can't right now think of something that could prove to me. But again, if that does exist, God knows what it would take to convince me. And if he wants me to be a believer, he would show me what it would be convincing to me, just like he did with Thomas. And I would be a believer and potentially convince, you know,
but you
thousands of people
that,
who listen to this show that I've been wrong for all this time.
But I thought you said at the beginning that even if Christianity is true, you couldn't worship that God.
Right, I did.
So you wouldn't become a believer.
Well, hold on. No. Being a believer is different from being a worshiper.
Okay.
I mean, you believe.
Sorry, we're at cross purposes because when I say believer, I mean a Christian, someone who loves and worships God.
Well, I mean, you believe in Satan, right?
Well, yes, I do. But okay. I guess that's the difference. Sure. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you believe, but you don't worship. Okay. So yeah, I can acknowledge the existence of a God without falling to my knees and giving him thanks.
Well, I think then it's important to draw this distinction because you're saying I'm willing to believe in God, but I'm not willing to love, trust and worship God. And that's interesting to me because God may not be actually very interested in simply getting you to believe in him, David. So maybe he's got no interest in making you believe in him by creating the physics in your brain that would make you believe in him or whatever it is that would take you. Maybe he's actually interested in you coming to love, trust and know him. And that may be a very different thing from simply getting you to believe in him.
Well, he had an opportunity when I already loved, trusted and believed in him. The Bible is what deconverted me. Reading it for what it says. And I'm telling you, just as you would say, I noticed that whenever you were talking just now, you were rattling off different points of evidence to your point, and you just sort of passed over all these prophecies of Jesus that came true. And then you just kept on going. I didn't want to interrupt. We've done that back and forth to each other. I'm trying to give you plenty of time to talk. But if you're going to count, to me, this is just a case of counting the hits and ignoring the misses. It's just like going to a psychic and, you know, if she says a couple of things that hit, you're like, oh, wow, she's amazing. But if she missed, you know, 8 out of 10 things, you don't focus on the misses because you want this to be true. So your confirmation bias has you ignore all of the bad things and focus in on the good. And I feel like if you're going to count these quote unquote prophecies fulfilled by Jesus, we then have to go to all of the failed prophecies of Jesus, things that he said was going to happen and didn't happen, or these things that he said that run in contradiction to what modern day Christians would say. Like the fact that he said, no one will pass away from this earth, who can hear my voice now before I return. Well, they're obviously all dead and he's 2,000 years late. We have multiple, and there are several books written by atheists built on this concept of Bible contradictions, Bible inconsistencies, problems with the Bible, and false prophecies of Jesus, things that he said were going to happen that never happened, things that he promised would come true that didn't come true, things in the Old Testament that they said Jesus would be that he turned out not to be, blatant contradictions. But when I talk with Christians who deal with these things, they seem to ignore those things or brush them under the rug because it doesn't fit their narrative. And I just don't think you get to have it one way and not deal with the negatives. I tried to be fair when I was a believer and I would take the things that hit, but I paid attention to the misses. And there ended up being so many misses that I could no longer take the hit seriously.
Mm. Again, we've both looked at all this material. David, I've done lots of shows on that whole question, hearing from the skeptics. Did a show recently on, you know, was Jesus a failed apocalyptic prophet with mm-hmm. someone who lost their faith on the very similar basis to what you're talking about there, with a theologian who, you know, takes the view that we need to understand the passages correctly, where Jesus is talking about things like, well, to our ears, very often talking about the end of the world and, you know, this generation shall not pass away before these things happen. And I think there's a very strong case to be made, for instance, in that particular instance, that what he's actually talking about is using apocalyptic language from the Old Testament to actually describe something happening imminently, which was fulfilled in the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. I think when you actually go to the text, understand, look into the context, you'll find actually that makes perfect sense of what Jesus is saying. And it's actually our 21st century gloss and unfortunately some bad theology as well that came in the early 20th century, the kind of, you know, rapture theology, millennial theology and all of that stuff that has kind of unfortunately led us down a path which we never needed to go down. I've looked at this same stuff and I've come to the considered opinion that actually it fits together, it makes sense. I haven't had the need to. I've absolutely gone through the same questioning process as you, David. But I've come to the view that actually Jesus is who he said he was. That we can trust the documents. That there is good evidence for the resurrection, and that and that all of those. I'm not saying there are no kind of mysteries or things in the Bible that leave me scratching my head. Of course there are. In a way, why wouldn't there be? You know, this is a document that has spoken to thousands of people over hundreds of generations.
Can you give me an example
of a thing that leaves me scratching my head?
Yeah, you said there are things. Do you have a few examples you can provide that things that concern you with the Bible?
Yeah, I could provide plenty. I think there are parts of the Gospels which can be difficult to reconcile with each other, and I'm not exactly sure how they hang together or whatever. I think there are ways of trying to, you know, doing that. I was looking at one just yesterday, which is the story of Jesus walking on the water. And as I say, because my worldview is one in which God can do miraculous things, it's not the fact of the miracle that's a problem. But what you find is in two of the Gospels where it's recorded, it's just Jesus walking on the water. And then in Matthew, you also get the story of Peter saying, Lord, if it's you, call me out onto the waves. And you get this story of him coming out and then losing his faith and going down and Jesus pulling him up. Mm-hmm. And the question that leaves me is, why didn't the other two Gospels have that? That's such a dramatic bit of the story. why didn't Mark and John also include that? And I don't know why. And it could be, here's one possibility. Maybe someone made the whole thing up. And then Matthew just added an extra bit of dramatic license in as well on top of it. That's one possibility, and I have to be open to that. But there are lots of other reasons for me to believe that generally the Gospels are reliable, and that there probably is a reason that I'm not thinking of or don't have access to why Matthew includes that story and the other Gospels don't. But I don't know. At this point, I don't have a kind of very solid theory on that. And that's just one tiny example of where there's a bit of a mystery in the Gospels. I'm not sure why these stories have what this one story has it and those other stories don't. But it's not something that sort of sends my faith tumbling down. It's just one of those things I hold in tension by the fact that I am a limited human being reading a book that has spoken to thousands of people over many generations in ways that are not all aimed at me, you know, and to satisfy my 21st century demands for a certain level of historical evidence that I think needs to be met, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, David Fitzgerald, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him or read his books, but his new book, Jesus Mything in Action. It's MYTH. He's a mythicist. He doesn't necessarily believe Jesus ever even existed. And he talks a lot about how Mark's Jesus is a very human Jesus. Mark's Jesus is the one who curses at the fig tree, doesn't understand why figs aren't in season, flips over tables, gets very angry. Someone asks Jesus why he calls him good. And Jesus turns and says, why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone. Obviously separating himself from the Trinity, saying God is the good one, not me. Is very human Jesus. Fallible, makes mistakes, angry, separates himself from God. And then David Fitzgerald makes the case that that's exactly what it was. It was a work of fiction, especially the way Mark ends with these women show up and the tomb's empty. And that's it. And it's like, dun, dun, dun. It's like a thriller, and it ends on a cliffhanger. And then Matthew comes along and sort of rewrites the story, but makes changes where he wants Jesus to be a little more godlike and more deified. And then Luke comes along and does the same thing with access to both Matthew and Mark's story. And then by the time you get to John, Jesus is completely one with God and completely deified. So these are it's almost like a person making an improvement upon someone else's writing, an improvement upon someone else's writing, and changing the story to fit whatever narrative they want. So sometimes they fit, sometimes they have direct contradictions about what Jesus' last words were, or what Jesus was wearing, or what color, you know, the scarf was, or the robe that Jesus had on him. Was it purple? Was it red? These things start to change as if you were in a writing room, you know, with different writers making those types of things happen. So I think New Testament, specifically within the Synoptic Gospels, having contradictions in them is a pretty important thing to talk about. Other than that, are there things that conflict with you, or are there things that you have trouble with in the Bible?
Well, if I could address a little bit, you know, what you brought up with David Fitzgerald there. I mean, firstly, I think the main problem I have with someone like Fitzgerald is I just think the position he adopts is simply historically untenable. And even, you know, skeptics like Bart Ehrman obviously think that that goes way, way beyond what you can possibly say, and that Jesus was clearly a historical character, even if you have significant issues with the historicity of certain parts of the Gospels. And with Mark, I mean, well, yeah, I suppose you could argue it is a more human Jesus in some sense. I think it's just a different, I think it's just a quicker, pacier Gospel. It reflects, the early provenance of it in a sense. But you've still got a Jesus who's walking on the water. I mean, that story is still there. It's just Peter doesn't join him on it. So clearly, this is more than just a human. The Mark details lots and lots of miraculous events. And the question about the empty tomb, well, that's an interesting one. There are scholars who say it ends in such a way that it looks like somehow the end of Mark's gospel got lost, that it's so abrupt that it just looks like the ending actually, you know, was lost at some point in who knows. The point is, though, actually, even in Mark, Jesus is still saying, making extraordinary claims about himself. You don't have to wait till John comes along for Jesus to be making divine claims. Jesus is saying things that in that context would have got him stoned. And indeed, you know, people did, you know, it's reported in Mark that people did try to stone him for the things he said. So for me, I don't think it's as simple as just, oh, you know, Mark started out with basically a human Jesus and then he got deified along the way. I don't think it's as simple as that at all but that's by the by. I mean, but this all just came out of the fact that you asked me, are there things that you find mysterious and struggle with? And all I'm saying is, yes, of course there are. That's natural. That's normal. But it's all about ultimately the things that obviously led you to the point, David, where you couldn't accept this anymore. There was too much. There were too many holes in the, you know, the house of cards came falling down, or whatever analogy you want to use. I've had the opposite experience. I've put myself in this position as the host of this radio show, week by week, inviting people on to make their objections against Christianity. And yes, some of them are hard. Some of them are actually quite hard to answer. And as I said at the beginning, it's not a comfortable process necessarily. But I've been surprised at the way in which Christianity actually has remained a credible option. And just the depth that I've found there, the satisfaction that I find in this worldview does still appeal to me. I still find it incredibly compelling. So, some of my views have changed. There are ways in which I think about the Bible that have definitely changed in 12 years of doing this show, where maybe I had a rather simplistic view of the way it's organized and constructed. And I've had to change that. But it's kind of made my faith deeper rather than shaking it. Some people, when a particular view they maybe grew up with, in say, you know, they grew up with some young earth creation view, and that gets challenged when they go to university, suddenly their faith comes crumbling down. I think that's incredibly sad, because all that is they were given a bad way of understanding scripture and theology, and their belief in that particular way of understanding the Bible is what collapsed. But I just think that was, they were given a bad way of understanding scripture. I think that actually taken in its context and with the right kind of attitude, I still just find Christianity a very compelling intellectual option.
So why is it that on your radio show, you tend to stay out of the conversation?
Because I'm the moderator, it's really about the other people. What we're doing now is really unusual, actually, David. I hardly ever have debates with people. So it's kind of, this is way outside my normal comfort
zone.
Well,
that's why you're still a Christian.
No, but in a sense, I'm there. I'm listening to both sides. I'm, of course, affected, you know.
Yeah.
Like I said, you know, if I hear a great argument against Christianity, I'm there. And, you know, and fair play to the Christians who listen to the podcast. They're having the same experience. But I think it's actually a really positive thing, because, I don't know, it's something about, it does tend to build a thick skin. When you start to engage with this stuff and honestly and not hide away from it, I think it can really, I kind of liken it in the book to, there's that proverb, isn't it, that iron sharpens iron. Mm-hmm. And I think if you've got a very brittle faith, it can be shattered very easily. But when you actually put it into the cut and thrust of these kinds of scenarios and really try and grapple with it and expose yourself to this stuff, it tempers your faith. It changes. Your faith might not come out quite the same as it did. You might have some of your preconceptions about Christianity and scripture challenged. But ultimately, I've found that it's toughened it. It's actually had this kind of invigorating, toughening effect where I feel much more confident in a funny way going into these kinds of conversations like the one we're having today, because I've kind of been given a bigger picture almost.
It seems like people in your position, and I don't mean this to be offensive in any way, I just think that people in your position seem to become calloused to challenges by theodicies. And for those who aren't aware of theodicies, a theodicy is a potential answer to a question. It's an idea that could be an answer, but we don't know for sure if that's it. And it seems like the reason it's strengthening your faith is because it makes you okay with not knowing answers by having a potential maybe answer, as to where I as a Christian came across these questions and the maybe answers weren't good enough. I wanted to know if I was right or wrong. And so a potential, this could be one theodicy that could explain away this issue. Well, if I didn't have enough evidence for that to be the case, I couldn't really get behind that. And maybe that's why your faith is stronger, is because it's easier for you to say, yeah, I don't know that, and that's really tough, but it doesn't keep me up at night because I think there may be something in the future that's going to resolve it. And that allows it to remove itself from your conscience, but that wasn't good enough for me. I needed to know.
Yeah. Obviously, we had I don't know what I'd describe it as, but maybe it's a different psychological reaction to it. And who knows what else is going on in the background, David? You know, we're different people. We've had different experiences. We've got, you know, we might have had a very different conception of God at the outset, or Christianity. We may have had very different, you know, examples given to us. Who knows what the fullness of what brings me to my point of view and you to your point of view.
I've even heard brain scans have shown the difference in how atheist brains work different from Christian brains.
I mean, who knows? I mean, the thing is that I guess we've looked at a lot of the same stuff, you and I, and we have come to very different conclusions about it. So I think it's not just about evidence in that sense. I think there's obviously going to be more going on at some level. You know, there's lots of it's. If anything I've said today makes it sound like I'm a Christian purely because I have these great philosophical arguments and this great historical argument and maybe this theodicy that gets me off the hook with God and suffering, well, no, that's not the reason I'm a Christian. These are all things that I think help me that kind of make sense of my faith. But I'm a, really, you know, I am a Christian because in some way that goes way beyond objective evidence, I believe I am in a relationship with Jesus Christ. There is something there that I find it difficult to deny at a kind of very fundamental level. Now, the objective evidence is great in terms of that gives me a platform on which I can then speak to other people and say, I think there's some good evidence that you could look at as well, because my subjective experience of this relationship with Christ is not something you can have access to, you know, that you haven't had that experience. But here's a scientific argument, here's a historical argument that might open the door. But I obviously a lot, you know, the point is that for whatever reason, there's a grounding there that the many objections I've come across have not been enough to dislodge, and that I feel there are enough arguments to kind of to go in the other direction.
Well, and that's great. And that's why I've saved the last chapter, the best chapter for last. Your very first chapter, chapter one, is called Conversations Matter. And I'm glad you started with that. Clearly you've showed that today. You've shown that with your, the existence of your show, Unbelievable, and coming on Dogma Debate, which is very much the same. That's the one thing we can definitely end agreeing on, is that these conversations not only matter, they need to continue happening. And it's not always about changing the other person's mind, you know, your interlocutor at the time. It's also about the listening audience hearing things perhaps they've never heard before, sending them back to their research of these philosophers, or their research into the Bible, or their reading into, you know, people like Fitzgerald or Ehrman or whatever, to dive in and find out, you know, what makes sense to you at the end of the day.
Yeah. And that's exactly the point I made in the book as well. You've preempted it exactly, which is, I'm not expecting in an hour of dialogue on my show to change the mind of the atheist guest or the Christian guest, you know. But it's the people listening that I'm really interested in, because there may be all people on all kinds of parts of the spectrum for whom these conversations are going to make a difference to the way they approach the evidence and whether they're willing to open themselves up, or, you know, or if they're on a trajectory away from faith. That's the thing with Unbelievable, is, you know, it's not a safe Christian show. Because there are people, you know, I get emails from people saying, Justin, your show has really helped me in my faith. It's helped me to kind of engage with skeptical arguments. Thank you. And that's great. But I also get people who say, Justin, I've been on a journey away from faith, and frankly, your show has confirmed it for me. I'm more convinced by the atheists. And I just have to accept that. That's the reality. Some people are going to react that way. I don't have much control. All I know is that I do feel I'm called to do this, and I'm called to do my best in bringing both sides of the conversation together.
Wait a minute.
But I kind of have to leave it to other people to make their own mind up.
Wait, you know, I get the exact same emails on both sides. I'm a Christian, and this strengthened my faith, and I've been on a journey away from faith, and you've confirmed it for me. I get both. But I'm curious, if you're called by God to do your show, am I being led by Satan to do mine?
Obviously, you're in league with the devil.
I have to be.
But that's touching on that huge question, in a sense, again, of God's sovereignty. And, you know, I think we're all doing what we do for a whole mixture of reasons, I think. I like the fact that you're doing what you do, David, because I think anything that provokes conversation, interest, and debate is good. I would love you to be a Christian, obviously, but the fact that you're an atheist and you're doing something that I think is worthwhile, I can also celebrate. And I think, you know, again, I hope this doesn't sound incredibly patronizing, but I think God is able to use your program. Even though you don't believe in God, you know, as a Christian, I believe God can use all kinds of things for his greater purposes, for anyone who's open. When I think of Richard Dawkins, I don't think, oh, what a terrible man, he's, you know, going against God. I think there's someone who is creating a really interesting conversation in the culture, one that I'm happy is happening, actually. I'd rather... I actually have a lot more interesting conversations with someone like you or Dawkins than with just a kind of agnostic who really doesn't care, almost. I'd rather have a kind of, you know, atheist who really knows what they think.
Let me say this. I don't find it patronizing that you said that about my show. I expect you to say it. I expect that to be your view. I would say, you know, if God, if you're listening and you're using my show and you have that ability, are you messing with my free will? I don't know. But if you're using dogma debate to reach more people and you have the ability to reach into this world and use things for the better good, let me tell you, man, you got a much better shot of using food pantries to feed starving people and using doctors to reduce suffering and cure some cancer in children. That'd be a much better use of your time than using, you know, a show with, you know, a few thousand downloads to make good arguments in favor of Christianity. Just my two cents for God. If he's listening. Well,
fair enough. I guess God has the luxury of being able to use all of those different methods for different purposes. But,
maybe so. Yeah. Well, the show is Unbelievable. Unbelievable? UK premier Christian radio, and it's a podcast. Go check it out on Apple Podcasts. And the book is Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. I can't wait to come back on the program. I really am looking forward to doing something like that. Give them the website one more time about The Big Conversation.
Okay, so The Big Conversation is this series coming up from 9th of June with some big hitters like Jordan B. Peterson and Peter Singer and Steven Pinker and Daniel Dennett and so on. And if you want to watch the little promo, it's there on the website now. TheBigConversation.show is the website.
Awesome. And for the book, it's unbelievablebook.co.uk, and it's available on Amazon. Justin Brierley, it's always a pleasure talking to you. I'm looking forward to doing your show as well. Let's stay in touch, man. I'd love to have you back on.
Let's do that. We'll definitely get you on again soon, David.
All right.
Nice to talk to you.
Sounds good. Take care, Justin. There he goes, Justin Brierley, the host of Unbelievable. If you're in the UK, you probably already know about him. Go check it out and grab that book and then email him and tell him how wrong he is. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, David.
You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.